I know my Lord is a man of war. He fought my battle at Hilltop door. Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, I'm free at last. Satan thought he'd have me fast. I broke his chain, got free at last. Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, I'm free at last. You can tender me here, but you can't hinder me there. Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, I'm free at last. The Lord in heaven wanna answer.
Good afternoon and welcome to Wanda's Picks, the Black Arts and Culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. I hope you all are enjoying these afternoon, summer times for the show as opposed to the 6 o'clock in the morning that I don't have to do right at the moment. And that was one of the spirituals that Friends of the Negro Spirituals gave me called Free at Last. And I'm not certain who the singer is. I'll have to find out and post that for you a little later on. But we are joined in the studio by Professor Angela A. Allen Bell, who is the Assistant Professor of Legal Analysis and Writing at Southern University Law Center. And we're going to be talking about the case of Albert Woodfox and also about Angola 3 and sort of the significance of that particular case and why it's important that we look at it, particularly around the issue of solitary confinement, the 40th anniversary of solitary confinement for the Angola 3, which made, what was that, April 17th?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, and there was a big rally at the state capital of Louisiana. And then subsequently, just last month, Albert Woodfox had a hearing, and Professor Bell is going to tell us about A3 and sort of maybe give us a little update on A3, like what is the case? And I'm sure people know the film Land of the Free, a more recent film, and Robert King has been touring a lot. He's the only free member of Angola 3. And his book, From the Bottom of the Heap, the autobiography of Robert Hillary King, is entering its second printing. It's going to be out sometime this summer. And, so let me read a little bit of your bio. Professor Bell is a 1998 graduate of Southern University Law Center in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and that's where you're working too, right?
That is correct.
That's kind of cool, you know?
I have to agree.
Yeah, and after law school, you spent 10 years working at an appellate court, and in this capacity gained an expertise in appellate law. And in 2008, you went to work as a law professor, and you are a committed public servant whose scholarly interests include social justice, civil rights, human rights, and prisoner rights issues. You find great solace, you write, in the written and spoken word, and you write and publish poetry and legal articles, so people should look you up because you've written some really interesting pieces and on some very timely subjects like Hurricane Katrina and Angola 3 and other issues like that. I wanted to ask you if you could tell us what does it mean to have an expertise in appellate law? What is appellate law?
Great. I'm glad you asked that because I was amazed every time I talked to people concerning Angola 3, the case history is so involved, and a lot of times people will raise their hand at that point when you start talking about them having filed appeals and say, what is that? So I'd love to have the opportunity to explain. The average citizen, when they have a court proceeding, they're familiar with having to go inside the district court or the trial court, whether it's a civil or criminal case. That's sort of where the witnesses are going to testify, the moving party or the prosecutor or the plaintiff, whoever's moving forward with this litigation. They get a chance to put their case on, and then a decision is ultimately rendered by the judge or the jury. That happens at the trial court stage. But once that part is concluded, the next step up is the appellate process, where the higher court, the appellate court, has the jurisdiction to go and review the things that took place at the trial court. The review is done from a written record, so there's no dramatic episode taking place. There's no witnesses testifying or anything. That court simply goes to the written record of what happened at the trial court, and based on that record, they review to see if there are any legal errors that took place. And so I spent 10 years doing a review of trial court proceedings, drafting proposed opinions. So if anybody's ever read any law books and you open up and you see those written opinions, that's what the appellate attorneys do. They draft those proposed opinions and, of course, present them to the judges to have them completed and finalized.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. So in light of this expertise, why don't you talk about Angola 3, the case, and why you are working so passionately around, justice for Albert Wood Fox and Herman Wallace?
Sure, I'll be glad to. The Angola 3 case is really two cases. There is a civil case at issue where the Angola 3 have alleged that there are constitutional violations surrounding the way that they're being housed in solitary confinement. And these gentlemen have been held now in solitary for a total of 40 years. So civilly, they have alleged that that housing assignment violates the Eighth Amendment to the United States Constitution, which outlaws cruel and unusual punishment. And they've also alleged that the housing assignment violates the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution by way of the Due Process Clause. The second case is the criminal cases both men have pending, and in those cases, they are challenging the convictions that are causing them to remain in custody. So they are now being held in prison because they were alleged to have killed a prison guard. Of course, the evidence is highly questionable, and those convictions have been visited now at least twice. And through the court system, those convictions have been reversed on two separate occasions. So Mr. Wood Fox, in his criminal case, is before the courts for a third time. He just had a hearing in May of this year. The issue in that hearing was whether the grand jury that presided over his third trial was somehow discriminatory in that it eliminated African Americans. And so that hearing was completed on May the 29th, and at the moment we are waiting on an outcome of that. And so we will figure out what that trial court does, and, of course, if there will be any subsequent action like an appeal being filed in this case. So we're sort of at a holding point. And why I have gotten involved with this case is because last year I started a writing project looking into some of the constitutional questions surrounding prolonged solitary confinement. And that writing project has now concluded. That paper is now published in the Hastings Constitutional Law Quarterly. And I then met with Mr. Wood Fox and Mr. Wallace to sit and share my findings and to thank them for supporting my work. And once we had that face-to-face contact, I knew from that moment that I was not going to step out of this because they are men who are innocent. They are principled. They have been wronged. And this is something that is intolerable. And as academics, as human beings, as professionals, as lawyers, as Christians, we have a charge. When we see wrong taking place, we cannot sit silently and accept that we have to speak up. Otherwise, our silence suggests that we acquiesce in this. And I did not want to have a hand in that.
So talk about this meeting, this face-to-face meeting with the two men, one at a time, and then maybe perhaps then talk about this hearing and what was supposed to happen, because Albert has had hearings in the past and been found suitable for release, And then the state, I'm not certain what court, because I get mixed up on which one is which, contested it, and then so then he didn't get out. So if you, I mean, I know you weren't at all of the 3 days, but you were there enough, and, you know, you're a legal expert, so.
I can certainly offer my perspective on the hearing and on the process.
Okay,
back in 2008, the same thing that was done in May was done. In 2008, there was a hearing at the Federal District Court here in Baton Rouge. At the end of that hearing, the judge, Judge Brady, was assigned to Mr. Woodfox's case. He concluded that Mr. Woodfox prevailed, and so that conviction that was holding him in custody was ultimately reversed. At that point, Mr. Woodfox could have walked out, but the Attorney General for the state of Louisiana decided to take an appeal up to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeal, and that caused a few additional years for Mr. Woodfox to sit and wait on a ruling, and ultimately the ruling was not favorable for him. So we are back doing the very same thing again. May was at the district court again before Judge Brady, who rendered that favorable ruling back in 2008, and now we're awaiting Judge Brady's ruling, and of course at the end of that the question becomes, will somebody take an appeal? Because somebody's going to win, and obviously somebody's going to lose. So that's where we are. And the thing of interest at this point is for the public and the world to consider the amount of money that the state of Louisiana has invested in fighting to hold a 65 and a 70-year-old man in solitary confinement for 40 years. There is absolutely nothing in their disciplinary records to suggest that this is warranted. And even more appalling, the warden has gone on record in a deposition to describe them as good and to note that there is no medical reason, no psychiatric testimony, no social worker, no infractions, nothing to suggest that they're dangerous men. Again, they're 65 and 70, and the state has spent well over $3 million to defend this type of conduct. And interestingly, there was just a hearing on June 19th, just a week ago. Senator Durbin called a hearing to explore this conversation of solitary and to raise the question of whether we should be doing this by way of our Constitution, by way of our international laws, and by way of all of our professional advice. During that hearing, there was a warden there from Mississippi who spoke very eloquently on the issue and explained that Mississippi has abandoned its practice of engaging in prolonged solitary confinement and has found that it has been a benefit to the Department of Corrections because, of course, the inmates have a motivation now to conduct themselves in a certain fashion as opposed to the old way of putting them in solitary and leaving them there until psychosis took over. So that's what's on the table now. It's the question civilly of whether the state will continue to defend this, although the world is crying out that this stop. In the criminal case, the question, of course, is whether this grand jury acted appropriately when it was selected. Did they exclude African Americans or not?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how was it when you met with Albert and talked to him?
Well, I happen to have had the misfortune of meeting with Mr. Woodfox on the weekend of his 65th birthday. And so I went very, very excitedly to share the news that the article had been accepted for publication. And I was overjoyed because I had a number of really respectable publication offers. So I thought that that would bring him some hope that maybe his story would be told in another arena, because it certainly has been written about before, but there was never anything written in any law journals exploring these constitutional questions. So I went with that degree of excitement and soon lost it when I realized that this was his 65th birthday. He was not exactly a happy person. He was very reflective about the mother who has died since he's been in custody. talked extensively about him being denied the opportunity to see her depart and say his farewells, talked about his sister who also has died since he's been in custody, and was very reflective about the fact that he was denied the opportunity to see her off as well. He is normally not in that state. He's usually very thankful, very encouraged by the support that people offer. That was just a rare glimpse into his humanity, his human moments, and I'm sure he has many, where the weight of what has happened to him was really, really measured that day. He's 65, and again, he's been held for 40 years in prolonged solitary confinement. Statistic alone, but when you have an innocent person, the harm is worse. And when you go back and understand the reason why he was ultimately put in this situation, the magnitude of this really weighs, because what this is really about, if you go understand the case history, is back in the early 70s when Angola was segregated, Mr. Woodfox, Mr. Wallace, and Mr. King did not want to sit by and watch men rape other men and men viciously murder other men, and they thought that if perhaps they could organize these inmates and form a Black Panther chapter, that there would be unity amongst the inmate population as opposed to this aggression. And so this comes from a place of good, and their good was obviously corrupted by a prison system who resented the idea that they were trying to organize. And so the harm of all of this really is greater when you understand that these are innocent people, and these are people who were acting to do good deeds amongst the population of people that was in chaos, and the state was doing nothing at all to help better conditions for any of these men.
Right, right. And then you, on top of that, not only were they, you know, looking at human rights issues, you know, around the practice of raping the younger inmates, you look at their political beliefs.
Yeah.
And that compounds the issue as well.
Absolutely. I certainly agree. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And just thinking 40 years ago, you know, 40 years, if Albert made 65 this February, then 40 years ago he was 25.
Absolutely.
And I'm like, wow, such a young man.
Yes, and if it were not for them having been falsely accused of murdering this officer, they would not be in custody. So it's important, too, to understand that they have already done the time that they were originally sent there to do. They're being held now on these charges that they should have never been placed under originally.
Right, right, yeah. And then your visit with Herman.
Herman's visit was much more upbeat. He is certainly at a place of hope after having seen the events develop on April the 17th. They're housed in two different facilities, and I should note that Mr. Woodfox is about 5 hours away from Baton Rouge, which is where I am. And he does not have access to a lot of the media that covers the things that take place here. Mr. Wallace is literally about maybe 30 minutes away from where I am in Baton Rouge, so he's able to hear and see certain things, and so a lot of what was covered on the 17th, he was hearing as it was covered. Some of the radio interviews he actually heard and wrote to me in one of the letters that the entire block got quiet, listening in with hope on that particular day that finally somebody's raising these necessary questions. So his reaction to the article was a lot more upbeat because he is seeing and understanding now that there is some efforts being made on their part, and there's some awareness taking place both in the state of Louisiana and elsewhere, because for many, many years there was awareness out of the country and there was awareness on the West Coast, but nobody knew about this in Louisiana. And so I would tell you for the last 12 months, that has been where the major effort has been, to make sure that the people right here in the state understand not only that this is happening to Wallace and Woodfox, this is happening to many others, and that it is happening with their tax dollars. And so now that that message has started to get out into the community, we're seeing a response, and that is bringing hope now both to Wallace and Woodfox.
Yeah. Could you perhaps tell us, you know, what's been going on since the 17th? I mean, there have been a lot of developments that you've sent me information about. I was wondering if you could let our audience know about what some of these unexpected and wonderful developments have been. That are
yes, I agree.
You've been
running
around and, you know, and doing
all they have definitely
writing.
Been unexpected, but they're certainly welcome developments. The major one was on the 17th, of course, we held a press conference, and that press conference was a first time that there were multiple organizations standing, making a public stance in support of this effort. The NAACP of Baton Rouge stood with us. The National Action Network of Slidell-St. Tammany stood with us. The Legislative Black Caucus actually stood with us. And, of course, Amnesty International was present. So that was a landmark moment because the movement grew from the Angola 3 Coalition to now we have other voices who are willing to go on record to say, I'm working to oppose this. Subsequent to April 17th, there was a congressional hearing. That was held just on June the 19th, and that hearing was called by Senator Dick Durbin. At that hearing, there were about five extremely impactful witnesses. One of those was Mr. Anthony Graves, who was an exoneree. There were a few lawyers, medical doctor. And then, of note, there were about 70 other people in organizations from all over the country who took the time to send statements in explaining why it is that this practice of prolonged solitary confinement has to be stopped. So this is probably the biggest movement so far of a diverse group of people. The statements came in from professors, solitary survivors, action groups, also family members, and religious groups. The other big development now is that there is a national religious movement against torture. They were there for those hearings, and they held a press conference, and they have organized quite well to bring attention to this from to the faith-based angle of it, that, you know, scriptures speak against torturing people. So the momentum is certainly picking up. And then the final development was just this past Sunday, June the 24th, here in Baton Rouge. There was a prayer service devoted to the Angola 3. And once again, we were able to pick up voices from the community who had not previously been involved. Now there's some faith-based leaders who are involved with this, city council members, probation officers. So that is the most recent and certainly a very significant development.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I was wondering, sort of in closing, if you could maybe talk about, put the this particular case in the context of other sort of high-profile cases, and then those that aren't as high-profile, considering I don't know if you have the numbers readily on the tip of your tongue of how many men and women and children that are incarcerated here in our country.
Certainly. I'll do my best with that. I don't know that there's any case on this magnitude. I don't know that it exists. I will tell you, though, when you ask the question about high-profile cases, that there has been, to my knowledge, this housing assignment is more extreme. What has happened to the Angola 3, the way they've been housed in solitary for 40 years, is more extreme than what has happened to some of the worst serial killers and terrorists in this country. That is certainly a point that I want to make. And in terms of trying to measure this against other high-profile cases, what I'll say to you is that what's significant about this case and how it speaks is that we have a lot of former activists, in particular Black Panthers, who were framed for things they did not do, who were murdered for things they did not do, and who were incarcerated for things they did not do. The Angola 3 happened to be two of many. And so in terms of a high-profile question, I think that this is high-profile in that they are symbols of a generation of people and a population of people who have never yet had the issue honestly confronted. They are a symbol for a need in this country, I think, to have a commission to evaluate these cases that have remained behind prison walls. From a civil standpoint, what's high profile about it, of course, is that they raise the necessary constitutional questions of how far can an institution go without crossing into the line of violating people's 8th and 14th Amendment rights. And finally, on to the issue of how many people's affected, there's an estimate of about 50 to 80,000 inmates in solitary in this country on any given day. Of course, that would include people who are in solitary for disciplinary as well as administrative reasons, and that figure would also include children as well as adults. This is a mass problem. It is serious, and it is time for the public to become aware of the extent to which this is taking place, because this is not only happening to people who have done something behind prison walls. The system is set up now so that prison administrators have so much discretion that they can put anybody in solitary. So you don't have to have done something behind prison walls to end up there. And what we see in the research is that most of the people there are very vulnerable people who certainly don't belong there in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And finally, is there a way that people can keep the pressure on with regards to Albert Woodfox's case and Herman Wallace's case?
Yes, yes, definitely. There's a way for people to text if they just want to stay in the loop with updates on the case. They would text to area code 504-535-4023. Second to that,
could you repeat that number again?
Certainly. They could text to area code 504-535-4023. And people could certainly email or call any of these three Louisiana officials. The first, the governor, Bobby Jindal. Second, the Department of Corrections, which would be Secretary LeBlanc. And third, the Attorney General, Buddy Caldwell. So people could reach out to any of those three people to speak their opposition to what is taking place with the Angola 3, or if people want to link in to know more, they should go to angola3.org to get case updates. And if people are interested in approaching this from a religious place, there is a website for the National Religious Campaign Against Torture, and that is certainly a way that the public can get involved and assist.
Wow. And people can also write Albert Woodfox and Herman Wallace, right?
Yes, they certainly can. They are especially encouraged when they hear the support of people. And also the thing to remember is that they are 23 hours a day alone. And then when they do get the 1 hour out, it is also alone. So the only human contact that they're able to experience is when people reach out to them and visit them, allow them to make phone calls out or to write. So the letters prove necessary, and they are the things that keep them sane. And every time I speak with them, that is probably the time that you will hear a smile in their voices when they are sharing words of encouragement that they have gotten from somewhere in the country or some member of the public. So please don't underestimate the value of that as well. That is certainly very, very important to them because, again, that is the only contact that they're able to have with other human beings at this point.
So when's the next time you're going to go visit them?
I have a visit planned for both of them in July. I'll be seeing both of them in July. I also have phone contact with them pretty regularly and mail contact with them consistently. So we are not going to allow this to continue. And my call to the public is for them to join in this effort. This has not been accepted when it comes to research animals. This is not accepted when it comes to stray animals. There are regulations in this country that will not allow us to house, research, or stray animals and leave them locked up in the cage forever. We just can't accept anything less than that for human beings, and in particular human beings who are innocent and principled. We just cannot accept it.
Right, yeah. Well, keep up the good fight.
I thank you.
Yeah, and, you know, certainly, you know, give our best to Albert and to Herman, and, you know, let them know that we're thinking about them, and definitely calling and texting and, you know, making sure that the government knows that we know that we are not going to stand for their being, you know, continue to be held in those conditions, and they should be released.
Well, I will certainly relay that, and I do appreciate your efforts. Again, they're 65 and 70. There are no children to fight for them. Mothers in both cases are now deceased. Family is limited. So they are definitely dependent on the public's efforts. And so I appreciate you for this opportunity, and thank your listening audience for the attention also.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and good luck on all of your endeavors, and look forward to meeting you.
You're welcome. Same here.
All right. You take good care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. So that was Professor Angela A. Allen Bell from the Southern University Law Center, where she is an assistant professor of legal analysis and writing. And she's done a whole lot of great work and great writing on this particular case. And you can actually read the piece that she mentioned, Perception Profiling and Prolonged Solitary Confinement Viewed Through the Lens of the Angola 3 Case. When prison officials become judges, judges become visually challenged, and justice becomes legally blind. And that's in number 39, Hastings Constitutional Law Quarterly, just published spring 2012, so it should be pretty easy to access. And I'll see if I can find a link to it, and if I can, I will put that on my website, wandaspicks.com. So we are going to be talking about Georgia Horton, who is coming up for parole, had an opportunity to visit Georgia in the sister-to-sister visits, which are a program of the California Coalition for Women Prisoners, which is out of the Legal Services for Prisoners with Children's Office in San Francisco. And one thing about Georgia in our visit that I noticed is that she is doing she's founded and started so many great programs there at the California, at the Central California Women's Facility, or CCWF, in Chowchilla, California, where more women are incarcerated than any other place in the world, and where there's another prison, Valley State, which the state is looking at converting to a men's prison. That isn't a sure thing yet, but that's what they're looking at doing. And I spoke to Georgia. Let's see, when was this? I spoke to Georgia on June, the weekend of June. Let's see, what day was that? It was the day that we had the libations for the ancestors. It was the the weekend of the second Saturday, which was the 9th. I think it was the 9th. Yes, is that the 9th? Oh, let me check my dates. Yes, it was the 9th, the second Saturday of June. And she said that in her gathering with the women before they started their particular group, that they would pour libations. And so we talked about that in two conversations, and we also talked about her upcoming parole hearing, and we talked about, sort of lessons learned and her work and what her plans are for her release and being a mother, being a mother and being reunited with her son after being separated from him, over 20 years. So this is the first part of that conversation, and we're going to be joined by a couple of other friends who actually knew Georgia, who knew Georgia because they were formerly incarcerated, but now they have been released. So here's Georgia Horton, the first of two interviews. So,
this recorded call is from an inmate at a California correctional facility.
So tell me about the libations for the ancestors. Let's start there.
I found out about the libation of the ancestors yesterday,
mm-hmm.
and I was able to incorporate it into the group meeting that we had yesterday in the institution,
mm-hmm.
with the ladies, and the response was just tremendous.
Mm-hmm.
It was just some of the response that we received yesterday was very healing. The ladies was able to relate the situations of the people in their past,
mm-hmm.
the people that had passed in their life today.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very profound. One of the profound emotions that I had, and I was able to myself be able to participate in the exercise, was Harriet Tubman,
mm-hmm.
but I related it to Deborah Denise Pigler, who was my Harriet Tubman of this century.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found it to be very insightful, and being able to call that up today and challenge ourselves in that spirit being carried out today. You know, what can we pull from that? And that was the question that I posed to the girls after we got through going around the room.
Mm-hmm.
What spirit or what characteristic could you pull from that today that you'll be able to carry that on and to challenge the girls in that area to who they admired or who they wanted to give to? You know, what would be one specific characteristic that you would want to challenge through the month of June? You know, to be able to exercise that where in your environment. And so the girls went around, and some of them had different things. Some of them were saying release, forgiveness, being able to embrace. Some of them said insight. The one I chose was vision,
mm-hmm.
to be able to see past where I was located.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the one I chose to mm-hmm. exercise in the month of June.
Wow, vision to see past where you are presently. Wow. Ah, that's beautiful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Maybe before it's over, I had wrote a little something concerning what I had felt and what I had seen. So maybe before we're through, I'll be able to just read a little small piece of what I...
Why don't you do that now?
Okay.
Yeah.
What I wrote is called If Vision Had a Voice.
Mm.
And how I go is, if a vision had a voice, I wondered what it would say. So I went inside myself and put out my history display. The first person I thought of was Martin Luther King when he spoke to himself, I have a dream. The next one was Rosie Parks, who worked hard every day. Her vision spoke to her, the back of the bus, not today. Then my eyes viewed the past slaves that struggled in the field just so their master could have a good meal. I wondered, under so much oppression, what could their vision possibly say? Then I heard a whisper, we will all be free.
This recorded call is from an inmate at a California correctional facility.
I stopped looking backwards and started focusing on today. For such a time as this, what would my vision say? Standing right here and looking around, knowing where I stand is ordained ground. They say words are powerful and that power is in our words. So today I gain inner strength and allow my vision to be heard. My vision is not for fortune or glamour while on this earth. No, my vision got birthed in my pain and painted by my hurt. I wish that one day all women would be free. But the liberation I speak of, with the naked eyes, you cannot see. Free from their past memories of trauma forced on them by wicked words. Free from beating their own self up with past memories and open words. Yes, freedom is a vision that still needs to be heard. Today I stand in one of the women's largest penitentiaries, over 4,000 women to be exact. I wonder how many carry bruises and where I'm hidden on their back. How many raped unreported and at night they are still crying in their beds. How many scared to parole because they have nowhere to lay their heads. How many of their children lost in the system, broken beyond repair. How many of them sitting on side of us, all made up, and last night suicide was standing right there. How many still dealing with the spirit of rejection, addiction, neglect, abandonment issues, and so much more? Yes, for such a time as this, I do have a dream, and it's ordained and given to me by my higher power. I hope you can come and join me while I'm on this task. Remember, what you do for people is the only thing that will last.
Wow, that's really beautiful. Huh? So you wrote that before or afterwards?
I wrote that
after the libations.
And yeah. So after I shared that, we was able to go into having a study at the chapel.
Mm-hmm.
And so upon sharing this, sharing our experience and then sharing this,
mm-hmm.
I was asked to read this today. So today in our chapel, I'll be sharing this.
Mm. Wow. So how many women were participating in the libations for the ancestors, and how did you explain it to them?
It was 45 women in the group, because I teach a class called Girlfriend, What Happened?
Mm-hmm.
And so I started off with that instead of starting off with the norm.
Mm-hmm.
And how I explained it to them is, from my understanding, was what we're going to do is today, we're going to think about who in the past, in our ancestry, no matter what your ancestry is connected to, have made an influence in your life, or who is somebody that you admire.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went around the room and allowed every woman to have their voice. And then I put another question out there. My other question I posed to them was, who today that's personally in your life,
mm-hmm.
that have passed on, that you would like to pay on?
This recorded call is from an inmate at a California correctional facility.
Have their voice. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I closed with, what characteristic that individual has, or what spirit of the person that you admired in the past and the ancestry have, that you would like to, I want to challenge you for the month of June to walk in today.
Mm-hmm.
And so people went around the room and they pulled up what the challenge was. And so we're going to meet again,
mm-hmm.
at the end of this month and see how the challenge went and what their experience was, and you know, how it related to them and how it affected them.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great. Had any of the women ever sort of done anything like this where they honored their ancestors?
No, and that was amazing to me because it wasn't.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's really beautiful. Wow. So tell me about Girlfriend, What Happened, this program that you started that has been adopted by the prison system with regards to working with mental health and rehabilitation. And you said that this particular program that you developed is, I don't know if it's the only program that has been developed.
It's the only, the program I wrote is called Girlfriend, What Happened, is the only program that has been endorsed by the CC system that
mm-hmm.
the inmates have designed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that I'm really, really, really proud about, is
mm-hmm.
that, and not only did it get adapted by CDC, but then the departments within inside the CDC system, because inside the CDC system we have mental health, which is a major problem situation that's going on with the women here, and as well as society.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, we have the drug problem
mm-hmm.
that's going on, that's plaguing society, as well as, you know, issues with hate crimes and prejudices and cultural problems and conflict. So the program is a conflict resolution class, but it's dealing towards trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times we don't understand, we look at the outward situation about why people are so upset or hurting or bruised, but we don't understand that they come from inner trauma, inner things that is going on the inside. And my time is up, so I'm going to have to call back.
Okay, sure. Okay.
All right, in a few minutes.
Okay.
All right, bye.
Bye. So that was just part one of a conversation that I had with Georgia. Early June, and we are joined in the studio by Hamdiya Cook's wonderful sister, Freedom Fighter, who actually knows Georgia, I believe, on both sides of the wall, right?
No, actually, I met Georgia in 2007 when I started visiting her at CCWF.
Okay.
That was the first time after my getting out for 20 years, I was able to go back into the state prison system and visit. And Georgia was one of the women I was really blessed to meet and visit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So tell us about Georgia. And also I wanted to mention that you you were formerly the executive director of California Coalition for Women Prisoners, and which had a reorganization. So you're on the board, but you have another job now, and I don't know what your title is.
I'm presently the administrative director for legal services for prisoners with children, and CCWP, which is really dear to my heart, is a we fiscally sponsor CCWP, so we're very invested in making sure that the women are supported under the banner of the California Coalition for Women Prisoners.
Mm-hmm, right.
Yeah.
And then I want to mention The Fire Inside, which is the newsletter that's published by and for incarcerated women. It had its 15th anniversary celebration last year in 2011. And that
yes.
was fun.
It was an incredible event, and Wanda, as a board member as well, played a big role in making that event happen, and we really appreciate it.
Yeah, and if people want to find out more about California Coalition for Women Prisoners, they can visit womenprisoners.org, and the newsletter is actually online as well.
Yes. Well, I'd like to just mention that Georgia is such a fierce, beautiful sister inside that had she not been there, so many of the opportunities that women are having, which, you know, are very limited, wouldn't even happen. She wrote this curriculum called Girlfriend, What Happened? And the curriculum is about raising your self-esteem and finding your purpose in life wherever you're at. And Georgia has been, you know, instrumental in helping hundreds of women find themselves inside that situation. And I applaud her every day. I support her every time she goes up for parole. And I'm just hoping that the world can see what a beautiful sister and benefit from her release someday. So that is, you know, what I want to say about Georgia. I'd also like to mention a few things about some of the current issues facing women prisoners in California right now. We had a law that passed in October 2011, and it's under the umbrella of something they call realignment. And basically what realignment has done, it is a law that shifts some of the criminal justice responsibilities from the state level to the counties. And people convicted of certain low-level felonies now have to serve their sentences in jail in the communities under the supervision of the probation department instead of the prison system. Now, the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, commonly known as CDCR, its plan as a result of realignment is to convert Valley State Prison for Women into a men's facility. Now, this plan will cram thousands of women from VSPW into the remaining two women prisons in California at CIW and CCWF, where Georgia's locked up, which will create a huge overcrowding and really potentially dangerous situation. So realignment sounds good on one hand. People are being sentenced to county jails. They're not sentenced so far away from home. But remember, the county jail system is not set up like the state prison system. Women will not be able to touch their children during visits. There is no contact visiting. They will have to see their children behind a glass for years and years of sentence, you know, getting a sentence for 3, 4, 5 years and have to do it all in the county jail. You're basically isolated from society in a way that doesn't happen in the state prison. You at least can get a visit one-on-one, and you can at least hug your family members. The idea that people would be serving time closer to their families sounds good, but there's just too many drawbacks to it. They don't have access to services. They get no gate money. Some will be under the supervision of the probation department when it gets out, when they are released, but most will not. They'll just be let out into the streets to fend for themselves after being locked up under almost torturous conditions in the county jail system because they don't get to see sunlight. They can't go outside. There's basically no recreation. There are no programs. So realignment is something that really needs to be looked at in a different way because it's not benefiting most women.
Mm-hmm.
Could
you talk a little bit about, for people that are not familiar, could you talk about the whole parole process? George is coming up for parole this coming month, early July, and I know there've been a lot of legislation around parole and how often you can go and what happens when you get there
Well, the problem with the parole situation is ultimately, even if a person is granted parole from the parole commission, they have to, that decision has to be approved by the governor.
Oh.
And more often than not, the decisions are reversed and people still don't get out on parole. So the parole system is a convoluted system that I really don't have a good handle on because I don't understand, once someone has been paroled, why aren't they just let out? Why does it have to have this other level of scrutiny? Because even to get paroled, get that decision from the commission is huge. You've worked very hard to make that happen. And then for that to be reversed by the governor, who at one time, a previous governor, said he would not parole any murders, anyone convicted of a murder, regardless of the situation, would not be paroled. And this ultimately gives people a life and death sentence when that's not what the judge intended when he sentenced people to a number of years. So the parole situation is dire. There's not a lot happening with that to change that at this time, unfortunately.
Wow, yeah, that is really unfortunate. Yeah, I was thinking about Beatrice Smith, who I hope will be joining us, and she said that maybe you could talk a little bit about the Habeas Project. She said that what happened is with the Habeas Project, which is a program that helps people that are victims of spousal abuse to get legal representation, and she says that what you said is that she was found suitable, and the governor said no.
Yes, and that's unfortunate, and that happens often, too often, more often than not. The Habeas Project is a project of legal services for prisoners with children, and it's ironic that you mention that because we are finding just recently that the Habeas Project is almost impossible to fund. So we are trying to fund the Habeas Project from general support monies because no one wants to, at least it's very difficult to get support to fund a project that you don't see instant relief. Some of these women, when we connect them with attorneys that fight for their cases under the Habeas Project, they fight for 5, 6, 7, 10 years before they can see any relief. And that just doesn't look immediate enough for any kind of change for a lot of the institutions that fund this work. So the Habeas Project is in need of support in so many ways at this time.
So how can people support the California Habeas Project?
They can donate.
Mm-hmm.
call Legal Services for Prisoners with Children and speak with Catherine McKee, who is our staff attorney supervising the Habeas Project, and just get more information about what the Habeas Project has done and is still attempting to do to help women in California be released as a result of being battered. California Coalition for Women Prisoners has information also that will explain what the Habeas Project does.
Yeah, is there a phone number people should call? You said call the attorney.
Yes, they can call Catherine, staff attorney Catherine McKee, 415-255-7036, extension, Catherine is, extension 315, and I'll transfer them. I don't have her extension right in front of me. I'm so sorry. She is a new staff member at Legal Services for Prisoners with Children, supervising the Habeas Project. Actually, it's 309, extension 309. I wanted to also just put a plug in here for what the women are asking, the demands that the women from VSPW and CCWF, they've written letters or signed petitions to stop the conversion of VSPW into a men's facility. And they wrote a joint statement calling on the public to support three demands. And I just wanted to read those demands to make sure that the public is aware that the women themselves inside are doing all they can to support and fight for what they see as their existence in these prisons. We demand the state to immediately halt its conversion program and to stop the transfer of women to the remaining overburdened women's prisons so we are not subjected to escalating abuse as a direct result of historic overcrowding. We demand that the state release enough people to address overcrowding of all people in its prison system. We demand that when overcrowding has ceased for all people, that the state close Valley State Prison for all people and repurpose it into a non-correctional community space. And this is what the women inside are asking. And I would really encourage the public to support what the women themselves who are locked up and know firsthand what happens behind those gates. Do to support them.
Right, yeah. Well, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule. Here's Sister B. I want you all to be able to say hello to each other.
Hi,
thank
Sister.
Thank you, Sister B, for joining us. I'm glad it worked out.
Thank you so much, Sister B. I'm really happy to see you out and active.
You're welcome.
Okay, I'm going to let you go now.
Okay.
You guys, take
all right.
care.
All right, sure. Thank you so much, Hamdia.
You're welcome.
All right. Take care. Peace and blessings.
Bye-bye.
Bye. So we're joined in the studio by Mrs. Beatrice Smith, formerly incarcerated for 16 years. And as we mentioned, the Habeas Project didn't release her, but it did get her an attorney. Why don't you talk about that, Mrs. Smith?
Well, thank you. The Habeas Project connected me with a wonderful lawyer named Denise Avery. And she fought for me for 7 years. We went to the board four different times before I was released. The board gave me parole. They granted me parole, but the governor overturned it twice. And so the last time my attorney took it to court, and the judge said he seen no reason why I was still in prison, and I was a battered woman, and the governor basically was wrong in his decision to continue to hold me.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And so you are the mother of 5 daughters and 2 sons, and you have 22 grandchildren and 1 great-grandchild. And talk about what you've been up to since you've been released. I think it's been 2 years now, right?
Yes, it'll be 2 years in August. The first few months, I was really just trying to get connected to my family again.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had a lot of different family functions and just really healing and talking and loving each other.
Mm-hmm.
And getting to know my grandchildren, because a lot of my grandchildren I didn't know. So after that, I started school. So I'm in school, and this is my, I think, my 3rd semester
mm-hmm.
in school. I'm doing really good in school. It's a little difficult sometimes. So the first year I tried, a semester I tried online. But not having a lot of knowledge about online, it was kind of difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So this year, the last 2 years, I've did campus work, which is really connecting to people. And because I'm so used to being around a lot of people, it was difficult being in such a large place and not knowing anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So... but that's what I'm doing.
Mhm. Yeah. Yeah. And when I spoke to you yesterday, I told you we were gonna be talking about your friend and my friend Georgia Horton, who is coming up for parole. And I wanted to know if you could talk about Georgia and what she's been doing at CCWF and the whole parole board. Saga that so many women, people who are incarcerated, prepare for, and you go up and you don't get paroled and you go back and you prepare for. That's where you can talk about Georgia and then talk about the whole parole hearing phenomena for our audience that might not be familiar with it.
I want to tell you Georgia has actively worked toward being a positive role model in CCWF. She's involved in a lot of activities. She's always first in line to volunteer herself and her services wherever she's needed. She's living in the honor dorm, which has classes, they sponsor functions, and They're just really involved in CCWF. And so she's really a part of that. She's really a part of her church. Anytime you go to church, you're going to see Georgia Horton. She's just a wonderful, positive person. And she deserves to be released. I mean, she's worked hard through these years. She's not a person... Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I'm listening. Mm-hmm.
Is it going in?
Yeah, I'm listening. You said she's a real positive influence on the women there. And she mentioned that, she started this program called Girlfriend What Happened that's been adopted by the corrections department. As one of the programs, and she's also, working, hosting groups and things like that. I remember when we would visit, you were also like a trustee of some sort and one of the members of the Long Timers organization that also sponsored programs there at the prison.
Yes, she is involved in all of those things.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there when she started her program, Girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real positive program. And what it does is it mentors the young women who are coming into prison, and it helps them to stay on the right track. It's so easy to fall into the negativity of prison, and there's a lot of negativity in prison.
Mm-hmm.
So she hit that and also involved again in a lot of her church activities.
Right.
I want to talk about the board because the board is, you know what, for lifers, it's so different. It's not like you have a date and you go home. You sit in front of two people who have maybe a couple hours to talk about your whole life experience. And some of your life experience for most of the women was abuse. And it's really hard for women to talk to men about the abuse they suffer. Some of them even have a hard time connecting themselves to that abuse. So it's really a difficult process. And each time you go to board, you relive whatever you went through at that day that sent you to prison. And most of the time it's the death of your spouse or the injury of your spouse or your mate. So it's something that is very, very difficult to face each time they deny you.
Mm-hmm.
And each time they deny you, your heart just breaks. You know, you think about the sympathy, not just for yourself, but for your family, for your victim's family, for your victim itself. It's a real painful process. You know, and each time, you know, I always thought there were prison guards that might even, some of them are not all bad, but most of them are. But there are some that supports the women in trying to get out by writing letters or giving good girl promos. I mean, even some of the victims' families try to help get these women out, and me included.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the board still never listens to them. It's really a hard process.
Mm-hmm. How many times did you experience that yourself before you were
I had a 16, 18 in life, and I actually had 15 to life and 3 years enhancement. So, you know, I didn't start going to board till my 11th year.
Oh.
By that time, I felt hopeless. I felt like it wouldn't work. I would just die there. And my first three times in board, I just didn't understand what they needed from me. So I went to board maybe about 5-6 times the first two times. And after the Marcy Law, which is the board cannot give you any, if they deny you, they can roll you, at least they can roll you over 3 years. So each time an inmate go to the board and they're denied, they start with 15 years and then they work their way down, if they work their way down to 3 years. So some women come out of there with 10-year rollover.
Mm-hmm.
If they're, I went in at 41. But what about those young women who are like in their 30s? And a man tell them, or a woman says, we're going to roll you over for 10 years.
Wow. Yeah.
Because you don't have your GED.
Hmm?
Or because you're not connected with your family. How can a lifer connect with their family most times? I mean, it's hard out here. It's hard for our families to even survive out here. Let alone visit them, visit me, or they can write letters, or even telephone calls. Even with those seven children, I only have one child that I could call. anytime that I wanted to. Because she was, at the time, was the only one could afford to answer the call.
Wow.
So how do a lifer connect with their family?
Yeah, that's a good question. And so by the time it was time for you to go before the board, you didn't have any feelings of hope because you had been in there so long, not being able to even advocate for yourself and your freedom.
You're right. You're right.
Wow.
I had no, you know, until the Harris Project got me a lawyer, I just thought I would die there, that I wouldn't be able to see the grandchildren that I hadn't seen or be around the grandchildren that I left. Or my children.
Wow, yeah.
And I always knew that I could be a positive role model when I got out. Because that's what I was before I went in.
Yeah, so talk about your life before you went in.
Before I went in, I was, you know, before I went in, I was a counselor at a recovery facility. I worked in the county jail for maybe 7-8 years. The one thing that I didn't do is I didn't really know how to take care of myself. My children, I came up in an abusive household, and I just continued to have that in my life through the relationships that I had. I was married for 16 years to the same guy who was really abusive, but not as abusive as my my husband. My ex was abusive, but not as abusive as my husband. So I just didn't learn how to take care of myself. What I did learn was to be responsible for other people. So I just, you know, better women don't, I didn't feel like there was a lot of ways to get out of it. I
even
didn't feel that.
Even though you were providing support to other women, you didn't see that there was support for you.
Well, you know, not only that, but I didn't even recognize it for a lot of years, you know, because we did things. We went on vacations. We both worked. We both worked in recovery. You know, so it was really hard for me to see how he had disconnected me from family and disconnect me from the people I work with and even in my household with my children.
So these were two consecutive relationships? So one was married and the other was
No, I was married to both. I was divorced from the first one and married. And then I remarried with the second one.
Okay, so you had consecutive abusive relationships?
Yes.
Yeah. So in the work you're doing now, you know, your studies, are you looking at, because you were a counselor before, are you looking at helping women identify positive and negative relationships?
What I do now is I do a little work, volunteer work for Kevin Grant, who helps, he motivates, and he has motivating talks with high-risk teens. So I do that. I talk about the risk of prison. I talk about the risk of being in abusive relationship. And I also do, in November, I'm going to one of the universities, and I'm talking about domestic violence. So I do, I have become involved in my community with the knowledge I have about abuse and substance abuse.
Mhm. Yeah. Was that a part of it as well? Because you mentioned that you both were in recovery, so substance abuse had been a part of the whole domestic situation.
I have been clean since 1980. So since 1980, that's 30-some years. So, and my early recovery, I was involved in recovery. I was involved in NA. I was involved in being supportive in the recovery facility. But I was in a relationship which he said, I thought he was clean. I can't say if he was or if he wasn't. I can only speak for myself. And I know I was clean.
Uh-huh.
But what happened is he didn't seek recovery. He didn't. It's not just about being sober. It's also about changing ideas and thoughts and, you know, turning your life around. And he wasn't able to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So talk about the impact of your being away from your family for so long, for 16 years. What's the impact of incarceration on your family? You mentioned that, you know, when you you've been out 2 years now, but initially, and probably continuing because it's only been 2 years, you know, you all were like sort of loving each other and trying to heal from this period where you were away and almost out of reach. You know, you said initially because only one of your daughters could afford the phone call, which is a collect call for those who aren't aware. Yeah, talk about that.
Well, you know, I think it was, I know it was hard on all my children. My four youngest lived in the house by themselves, and my two oldest, helped them until they was old enough to get out on their own. But it was difficult for them. I mean, the first things my four did was stop going to school, which is probably the saddest thing that I can think of for me, you know. At 62, I continue to go to school. So I think school is so important in our lives, you know, if you want a better life. And here my children had no adult in the household. And my two daughters, older daughters, and they weren't that much older, they was only 18 and 19, had to support and take care of my four youngers who were 10, 12, and 14. And they were there by themselves.
That's really young.
Yes. Yes, they were young. You know, and I really didn't have a lot of communication with them because I had no way, you know, just purely I could talk to them. And my baby daughter, I realized that I didn't have a relationship with her at all. So what I did in my last couple of years is I just wrote her. I would write. It didn't matter what I wrote. I just write a letter. You know, I try to do it every weekend. And she didn't, by that time, her relationship is I love my mom, but she did never wrote back. I think she wrote me twice. You know, and I just had to keep pushing and continue my relationship with letting her know who I was as a person. So it's really difficult, again, for lifers. I mean, at one point, years ago, they used to let us have family visits.
Right,
Who needs a relationship with their family more than lifers? Mm-hmm. I mean, even to come out here, to come back home and with no connections with family, what happens? Or very little connection with family. You know, it's not been an easy task for any of my children to reconnect with me. And I came out after 16 years with some attitudes that I've had to look at and then address.
Like what?
With them.
Like what?
For one thing, in prison, you only have your word. If you're a liar, you're a liar, and people find that out, they just stop dealing with you. So you learn to be truthful and honest, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when people when I first got out and they didn't believe me, I would get really angry because I was like, all I have is my word, but that is my prison attitude. That is not something that happens out here that other people just take it for. They just take, you know, if you lie, okay, well, it's okay, it's just a little lie. But for us, at that time in prison, I mean, it's everything. Your word is your bond.
Uh-huh.
So if I say I'm going to call you, I can't understand why you didn't call.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So those kind of attitudes I have to look at. And when people say they're going to call me, they might just be talking. But for me, it was a trust thing. You said you're going to call, so I expect you to call.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I had to kind of loosen up on some of that. Some of it has, you know, with my younger grandchildren, sometimes it's difficult for them because I went in at 41, but I'm 62 now, so I'm really the grandma.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like my grandma.
Mm-hmm.
So they get mad at me sometimes, but I always figure they'll get over it.
Yeah.
Even my daughter.
Mhm. So, you mentioned about so people that have life sentences can't have family visits anymore?
No, they can't. Life is haven't had any kind of visit, family visits that they can stay over for maybe the last 13 years.
13 years. Wow, that's a long time.
Yeah.
Wow.
But for me, I think they needed more than the person that's going to go ahead and come out in 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is my phone going in and out?
Yeah, it was. Now it's better.
I think it's the way I might hold it. But I have it on the charger, so it doesn't get low.
Okay.
But anyway, what I was saying about your and it doesn't have to be a man-woman relationship when I say a family visit. I'm talking about mothers. I'm talking about children.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about nieces and nephews, just to know your family, to
mm-hmm.
continue to know.
Right.
And some do have husbands. But, you know, for women, most men break off the relationship with women in prison.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, so we're really talking about immediate family of mothers and fathers and uncles, that type.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe having a family visit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So since you couldn't have family visits, like, you know, overnight or weekend, I know a woman that we visit, Patricia, who I hope is released soon because she's dying behind bars, Patricia Wright. And I know you did a lot of work in the skilled nursing facility and the hospice in particular, I believe. But she said that there's a limit on how many visitors you can have at any one visit. So she could never have a visit where all of her children and her grandchildren could come see her because there's a head count. Like, you'd only have so many.
Yes, you're right.
Hmm.
Well, you know, it's really difficult for family anyway to come. I mean, if you have a person that's dying in prison and when they left a certain way. They left healthy and they left, you know, vibrant. And you come to visit them in SNF. And SNF is not a place that a person want to die in. It's a lonely, isolated, locked facility. And very few inmates are allowed back there. So the only contact you really have is nurses and doctors who are very impartial to who you are as a person. It takes away the desire and the will to even live.
Wow. Yeah. How long did you work in the skilled nursing facility or the SNF?
From 1996 to 2010.
Oh, you were there a long time.
Yeah. I was the peer counselor at first. I did different positions, but the skilled nursing facility always had a special place for me because how sad it is to be alone and dying.
Mhm. Yeah.
So I was just blessed, and that's how I feel. I'm just blessed to be able to see the world.
Mhm.
On a regular basis.
Right. Yeah. So for a lot of women, you were that comforting presence as they made their transition.
I believe they were my comforting presence. They were in my presence, but they were comforting to me.
Mm.
I was just blessed to be able to be there with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I did sit with maybe 6 or 7 women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because I know we've Debbie Pigler, Georgia mentioned her, and she said Debbie was like her Harriet Tubman. She really drew a lot of strength and inspiration from Debbie, and lucky, you know, luckily Debbie was able to get you know, the compassionate release so that she didn't have to die behind prison walls. Her story is told in the film Crime After Crime.
I love Debbie.
Mhm.
Actually, his name is Deborah. Nobody ever thought of Debbie. Is Deborah. I think called it Trip.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she was just an inspiration to everybody. Anybody that knew her, loved her. Anybody that knew her, admired her courage.
Right. Yeah. So for people that are concerned about the women behind bars, there's so many women incarcerated in the Central Valley in Chowchilla, California. That's not the only place where the two prisons are, but the largest population, the largest concentration of incarcerated women is certainly in the Central Valley, California. The Central California Women's Facility and Valley State, and Hamdia talked about that one, and the pending closure for the women and looking at making that prison to a men's facility, and hopefully that won't happen. But for women, people that are concerned, and what would you suggest, maybe 3 things that people could do?
One, you could go online and look at the different policy changes for women. And get actively involved by writing letters or talking to your neighbors. But also you have lots of different wonderful, wonderful programs that are supporting women in prison. You have LSPC. I'm sure Humdia talked about the different programs that you could get involved in to support women very few have anyone.
Yeah, the LSPC is Legal Services for Prisoners with Children, and that's the program that Hamdia told us about, and she's the, what's her title, administrative director or something like that. Yeah. And the other, and also people can find out about the policy changes. A lot of that information is in the Fire Next Time, the Fire Inside the newsletter that's published by and for incarcerated women. And again, you can read issues of the newsletter on the website for California Coalition for Women Prisoners, and the website is womenprisoners.org. And your third thing?
And my third thing would be pray.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing more powerful than prayer.
That's right. Yeah. Well, excellent.
So, I hope I was able to do what you needed me to do.
Oh, it was more than I could have even expected. It was really lovely having you on. I've been wanting to have you on since I got the great news that you were coming home, coming off the plantation. And I'm really happy that we're finally able to have this conversation, and hope we'll have others. And good luck on all of your studies and your work. And it was great seeing you and your sister at the Sweet Honey concert. That was really nice. And
that was
fun. So we have to do some more fun things like that. So tell you, Dottie, thanks so much for letting us interrupt your family time with this conversation and interview. And again, thank you so much for joining us, and we look forward to further conversations.
Okay, you're welcome. Right.
You take good care.
All right. That's true. Bye.
Peace and blessings. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So we're speaking to Mrs. Beatrice Smith, and waiting for another guest to call into the studio. Oh, wait a second. That might be her right there. Ah, is that Sabina?
This is, yes. Hello.
Oh, perfect timing.
Wonderful.
Wow, if it wasn't a play, Medea would be in prison.
Right.
Oh, my goodness. You really rock that role. You are so good. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's quite
phenomenal.
An amazing, amazing piece.
Oh, you are just, oh, my goodness. And the costumes and the ritual. It's just such a beautiful retelling of the piece. I mean, set in San Francisco's Mission District. I mean, you know, who would have known that there was
a
goddess there? And
oh, we're
God,
everywhere.
And all this stuff was being worked out.
Yeah, I know. It's amazing how it all comes together just from, you know, a wonderful idea from Luis and Loretta. This is what sprouted, you know. It's pretty impressive.
Oh, yeah. And I did see Oedipus L. Ray, that, you know, the piece that...
Oh, yes.
That was, whew, man.
Mm-hmm.
That was
mm-hmm.
really wonderful. And I didn't even know that the Magic Theater, you know, was helping him develop this piece now. You know, the reimagining of Euripides' Medea. Yes, really great. Yeah, a friend of mine told me that you all, you know, really knocked the socks off of the Laney College audience when you did
Oh, that was such a wonderful, that was a wonderful experience. Such a great community to bring it to.
Mm-hmm.
It was just really profound, a lot of what the audience said afterwards. We had a talk back, and I remember one woman sharing how glad she was to be able to see that it's okay to sometimes have negative feelings and thoughts. Everybody has them. We're taught that it's really bad, and it's not good to have those kind of thoughts, but everybody does, you know. And then she said, I'm going to go back home, I'm going to look at my family, and really push that we all respect each other and listen to each other, you know. And it just was really great that she took it so personally.
Yeah. There was, the story of Medea and the man she loves has so many different levels. Why don't you, before I introduce you, I'm going to read the bio from your website, which is so much more interesting. It's like, wow, your family is really hot. But anyway.
Yeah.
why don't you give audience a little sort of a synopsis of the Medea and and then I'll introduce you, and then we'll talk more about the piece. And I want to let the audience know that Bruja is actually written by Luis Alfaro and directed by Loretta Greco. Is being extended at the Magic Theater at Ford Mason Center in San Francisco through, I believe, July 1st. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, so you have an opportunity to see it tonight, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Saturday we are dark, and we're doing two shows closing on Sunday. So no show Saturday. Sunday we have a 2:30 and a 7 o'clock.
Oh, so Saturday you get to eat your
body. Going out crazy.
Yeah. Wow, twice. My goodness. I mean, there's no intermission. Yeah. Ooh, that's going to be heavy duty. Oh, man.
It's 85 minutes. It goes straight through. It's wonderful. And then doing it twice in a day is actually quite exhilarating.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So I was just thinking, doing it twice in one day, you might need someone to drive you home. But the only thing
nice about it is
you're right on the water, and it was so beautiful last night. It wasn't cold, and the sun was still up, and you could look at Mount Tamalpais, and it was just so beautiful to be able to come out, because your character, in the end, dressed in white, she flies away.
Yeah.
And so you could see her, leaving the theater, flying through the roof.
There you go.
Over the water.
Out across the water, yep.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely. So, well, back to your, for a synopsis for Medea, it's, a classic Greek myth that was written about a woman who was from one country and then fell in love with a man and traveled with him to another country. And along the way, she did everything she could in her power to help him excel politically, socially, pretty much gave him everything she could. And in the new land that she ended up with Jason in, she was looked at as an other, as an immigrant, as a threat. And then stuff goes down. I don't want to give it away if there's any people out there that might come and see the show, but Jason meets somebody else and sees it as an opportunity to help not only himself, but Medea, their children, the whole family kind of elevate socially. And when Medea finds out about his plan, she's not too happy with it. So she decides to take things in her own hands. And that's the classic retelling. And in this one, Luis has amazingly transferred the story to a young immigrant couple from Mexico who leave their home and come north, as so many do every day. And he tries the same thing. He's trying to make things better for his family. She's looked down upon as an immigrant, as a threat, especially because of her work. Medea is classically known as being very gifted with herbs and potions, somewhat of a sorceress. And in this one, he's turned her into a curandera, which is a traditional Mexican healer, who uses herbs, uses her hands, uses ritual to heal and help people. And people are scared of her. They call her a bruja, a witch. And she can really feel that otherness. And she has, not only as an immigrant, feels isolated, but also as a woman living in this new country where it's very controlled by the men around her. So, it is a classic drama, but there's some wonderful culture in it. There's a lot of great comedy from the character of Vieja, the woman who plays the nurse and stands in as like the Greek chorus. So it's a very vibrant piece.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. And it's so beautiful.
The set, the costumes,
light,
the lighting.
And there's
and the
like
sound
real
design
Kyle
is awesome.
Pardon me, say it again?
Mm-hmm.
The
sound design is something that really amazed all of us up on stage, being surrounded by the beautiful sound design from Jake Rodriguez. Mm-hmm. Really brings to life the setting.
Right, yeah. And then in the program, they sort of bring in some of the mythology from the Mayan Mayan culture, and I don't know how familiar you are with that, if you wanted to talk about that with regards to, because when you go in, you know that you are entering the spiritual realm, even before, the altar is there, right there, and it's like, I see some elements on there, like the floor water, mm-hmm. the floor water. I said, oh, they got the real stuff.
Yeah.
And then there's a fountain, and Medea is, she's got a patient who wants to have children. And is this Creon? Is that his name?
That's Aeos, Aegeus.
Aegeus, yes, Aegeus, right.
Yeah.
And and so, you know, he comes for regular treatments.
Yes.
And
he's one that's kind of straddling both worlds, you know. Mm-hmm. He's come, he's made a name for himself, but he, like he says, he can't let go of the old ways. He knows they work. He still has respect for them, even though the men around him keep telling him, you know, you shouldn't be going over there. They, you know, they don't trust her, but he still has, you know, a lot of love for the old ways.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And he tells Medea that he sees the old country in her. Because
yes.
Medea is holding on to her heritage. She loves
mm-hmm.
being, you know, who she is, and she mm-hmm. doesn't want to be American.
No. I mean, one of my favorite, you know, physical aspects of this role was when the director had told me, you know, I don't see you wearing shoes throughout the play. And I just thought, that's perfect. There's, you know, I get to be barefoot throughout the whole piece. And that really, for me, represents something very special about Medea. She's very grounded. She's very in touch with the earth. And she doesn't want to cover that. She's very open.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And how do you pronounce it? Aegeus? Is that how you say it?
Aeos.
Aeos. Aeos.
Yeah, he kept all the Greek names, and then we just put our little Spanish pronunciation on it.
Yeah, and also...
Creon, Aeos.
And the actor is Armando Rodriguez, and he was also in Oedipus El Rey, so he's familiar
yes,
with...
Yes, he was Creon, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, oh, that's why I thought Creon, okay.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But there is a Creon in this one, and Carlos, how do you pronounce Aguirre.
Mm-hmm.
Aguirre,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the cast does speak Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
in the play, but... They also speak English.
But yeah,
I remember seeing Carlos in quite a few pieces. I saw him in Day of Absence at Lorraine Hansberry Theater, and I saw him
mm-hmm.
in Lily's Revenge, and I saw him in mm-hmm. El Rey, and so in Wilma Bonet, Vieja, I've seen her before. So it's like, wow.
Oh, she's a veteran on the bass theater scene.
Yeah.
She's been around forever. She's wonderful.
Yeah, and then Medea's counterpart, Hassan,
mm-hmm.
and I'm like, I'm trying to figure out, Hassan, how do you spell that? And I'm like, oh, that's right, that's the J.
Yeah, there you go.
And then I'm pronouncing Sean San Jose, but I'm thinking, oh, because of the, but we say Jose, but is it really Sean Jose?
Yeah.
Oh,
Sean,
yeah,
San
yeah,
Jose.
It is the H,
mm-hmm.
yeah. Anyway,
yep.
I was like, whoa, Sean is really like, oh, I haven't seen him in anything this powerful in a while.
Yeah,
you all are really dynamic beside each other.
Oh, he's so thrilling to work with.
Mm.
He's just, I mean, it's, I just love sitting on stage and looking across at him, especially at the dinner scene, listening to him tell the story of how we met,
mm-hmm.
you know, and when he's really trying to explain to me what he's trying to do. It's just, it's great to go from being really in love with somebody and having such comfort and relaxation with somebody on stage and then arcing all the way to just, you know, getting physically violent with each other and yelling at each other. It's a joy to be able to do that with someone and feel really safe and productive with him. He's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And then the secrets, you know, that both characters harbor. And
mm-hmm.
and then, you know, going back to, you know, you're sitting across from each other at the dinner when the big man, you know, Creon comes to dinner because he wants
mm-hmm.
to meet you, Medea.
Yeah.
And then the birds. I'm like, wow, the bird imagery. I'm like, wow, that sounds wow.
Yeah, wasn't that a fun thing? That mm-hmm. really sprouted up later in the rehearsal period. It was just something that started off very small and then, like a bird, just took flight and kind of became a through line throughout the play
mm.
that just, you know, captured everybody when he started, Luis started writing it more and more, and it became this symbol of their conversation and their dialogue with each other,
right,
all the way through to that last moment.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah, because at one point he says, he called Medea his bird, you know.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, it was interesting. Luis Alfaro went to Chicago yesterday, so Sunday we had a little going away party, and we've all been missing him a lot. And written in the script, the way that the bird call is written is GWA, GWA, GWA. That's how it's written out. And it's, you know, the wah, wah, wah. And I went on his Facebook page yesterday, and I just wrote those three little words. Just, you know, let him know that we're thinking of him and missing him, our other little bird, you know.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and you think about, you know, sort of the, think about birds and, you know, what they're symbols of. And,
mm-hmm.
and we know that everything has multiple layers. Like, nothing
yes.
is as it seems. And,
mm-hmm.
and that's when the lighting and the sound and the set and the, you know, the action, you sort of really comes together, particularly like, for instance, when, you know, as a healer, you know, Medea has all of her different, you know, sort of, I guess, you know, the, what is it, up, you know, the different parts. You know, she's got her leaves and she's got her
mm-hmm.
different,
mm-hmm.
you know, potions and whatever. And
mm-hmm.
And then when one, you know, when her, you know, her beloved, Hassan says, okay, I want you to work something on me. And and what, you know, tell us what, you know, tell the audience what she says. And then that whole
yeah.
heart scene is like, it comes back.
Mm-hmm.
That is so phenomenal because the heart is on
yeah.
the wall.
Yeah, that
like,
was really,
ooh.
It was great because Luis had written in the script, Medea shows Hassan her heart, a beautiful, and it's white and pure. And I was just like, wow, how are they going to do this? This is going to be amazing. And what it comes from is, and this is really interesting, I did some research with some curanderas back in New Mexico, and I was speaking with Antonita Gonzalez. She's known as Tonita in New Mexico. And when I told her about the part before the heart where Hassan asks her to work on him, and she says, I can't, because you're too close to me. You know, I need the distance to be able to see what it is that I'm healing, and with you I only see your heart. And Tonita shared with me that as a curandera, she herself and who trained her and a lot of people in her circle, they will not work on family members or loved ones. Because when you do, you are able to read and see things, some things that maybe you're not supposed to see because of your healing powers, things that maybe are a secret for a good reason. And when you're too close with somebody, you can somewhat be a little too invasive because you're connected. So it's really not suggested to work on a partner or to work on a loved one because it's sometimes it's just not good when they're that close. So I was really interested that she confirmed what Luis had already written as Medea's response. So then instead of, since she can't give him that, she gives him the only other thing she can, which is to show him her heart, to really open up and be as naked as she can in front of him. And that was a beautiful vision that came about with, you know, the set designer, the whole creative team. They videotaped me with my hands on my chest, revealing my heart, and then projected that on top of me. And I actually have not seen what it looks like. I have no idea what it looks like. But I hear it looks great.
It does. It looks great.
Yeah. So today I'm here in the office today, and I'm going to watch a video that the magic had taken of one of our rehearsals, because I said, I really want to just see a couple parts so I can see what the projection looks like. So I get to see that today.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I was looking, how do you pronounce it? Curandera.
Curandero.
Curandera.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And saying that this the folk healer, you know, works on different levels, material, spiritual, and mental, and
mm-hmm.
and he or she combines both religious and supernatural elements, and mm-hmm. and one either has become an apprentice or must have a gift. And from what Medea tells us as her backstory, she had a gift, right?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't hear her that she had been an apprentice to anyone.
No, well, there's also a little bit of a relationship between her and Vieja, and, you know, some of
yes.
our table work around the table was the relationship between Vieja and Medea. As Medea was younger, she's always had that gift. She's always, you know, people knew, and this is all stuff that we talked about off stage. But I think her relationship with Vieja, who had been with the family forever, also influenced and nurtured her gift. I had kind of decided that Vieja had taught me a lot about the herbs,
mm-hmm.
you know, that I already had the healing and in my hands and everything, but Vieja helped me learn more about herbs. So I feel like there was maybe a little bit of apprenticeship there.
Okay.
You know, and it mirrored actually a lot of the rehearsal process of me learning from Wilma, who works in Santeria. You
oh,
know, and so she works. She does.
Oh,
and so
wow,
she
you
really
had an
shared
expert.
A,
oh my
yeah,
goodness.
Yeah. So she helped me out. I come from the curandera world with a lot of my folks back home in Albuquerque. It's been around me forever. So I came with that. She came with that. And she taught me a lot of stuff. So the rituals we did on stage were a shared creation between the two of us. So I feel like we really did have that relationship, like Medea and Vieja, learning from each other and working together.
Yeah. And what I really liked about the relationship between the two women, Medea and Vieja, was that one was really young, and I don't know how young Medea is, but when Hassan and she become a couple, she's really
mm-hmm.
young, because he looks at her, you know, mother of
mm-hmm.
twins, and he says,
yeah.
"You're really young, aren't you?"
Yeah.
So it's like,
yeah.
how young is she? And I think he means also innocent too.
Definitely, definitely. And, you know, Luis wrote her to be in her 20s.
Okay.
Because when he and Loretta visited with Mary Hart, a wonderful scholar that works at the Getty Villa in Los Angeles, they couldn't wrap their mind quite around how they were going to tell this story, because Medea is always portrayed as this older shrew
yeah.
who gets jealous of a younger woman, that Hassan meets this younger woman, and that's the jealousy. But what Mary said was, you know, if we're really going to go historically, Medea would have started having children at 13, 14, and would have been done by about 19. So if you really think about it, she would have been in her 20s, and Jason would have been in, you know, his 40s or 50s. And
oh,
then all of a sudden,
a light
came on for them to think, oh, okay, so she's younger. You know, she is somewhat innocent in the fact that she's just true to her era, her life, her country, so that when she comes to this new country, she is very new, very naive, very young.
Oh, wow. Yeah, and because of her youth, I see Vieja as helping her control her passion because she's not mature. And so
yes.
she would tell her to think, you know, to
mm-hmm.
to be still, to gather herself, and to not just go crazy, because if you go crazy and you're powerful, you do a lot of damage.
Exactly. Yeah, she really tries to tell her, look, you know, this is more powerful than you are. She knows the potential that Medea has, and so she tries her best
mm-hmm.
to keep her in check. It only lasts for so long, though.
Right, yeah. Right. And so I want to introduce you, because I've been promising and I haven't read your lovely bio yet. And then I want you to talk about your name, because I see Zuni in there. It's like, oh, it's like, you know, let's talk about that a little bit.
Definitely.
So you were born and raised in New Mexico, daughter of a civil rights activist and a Vietnam veteran. Raised on red and green chili, elk meat, jazz, and Cat Stevens. A graduate from the prestigious MFA program at the University of Southern California, and you currently reside in Los Angeles. You're a founding member of Teatro Nuevo Mexico, a Latino theater company, and currently member of the Latina theater troupe Las... How do you say that?
Mega Ninas.
Mega Ninas. What does that mean?
Mm-hmm. It means little big girls.
Okay. Currently, you tour with Will and Company in the show Portraits of Courage, Latino Shaping a Nation, written and directed by Colin Cox. Have you been up this way with it?
I haven't yet. No, this fall, August and September, is Latino History Month.
Mm-hmm.
So he's got a bunch of different colleges lined up. It would be great to bring it up here. I think Laney College would love it.
Okay, yeah. Well,
yeah.
Let us know. I teach at one of the sister colleges, College of Alameda. There are four colleges in our district. So, yeah, that'd be really super.
Oh, yeah. That'd be great. I can. They have a website, willandcompany.com, and they have all the information on how to get the show up to places. And I will definitely, I can get call in touch with you. That'd be great.
Oh, that'd be excellent. Super, super.
Yeah.
Let's see. Zuniga Varela is
yes.
Recipient of the 2007 Best Female Performer of the Year from the, is it New Mexico? Hispano Entertainers?
Yes.
Entertainers Association,
yes.
For a portrayal of Frida Kahlo in Still Life. I thought that was nice. I love Frida Kahlo.
Oh, yeah.
And when you all were talking in the play about Mishawakana, I'm like, oh, I've been there. My daughter
was
at the University of Guanajuato for a semester,
oh, nice.
And I visited her there and got a chance to tour a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so Frida Kahlo in Still Life, produced by Camino Real Productions, which opened at the National Hispanic Cultural Center in Albuquerque and subsequently toured to San Miguel Allende, Mexico. She was
mm-hmm.
honored to perform the roles of Masha in Three Sisters, directed by Kate Burden, Festi and Antonio in Twelfth Night, directed by Andrew J. Robinson, and six various roles in an original piece entitled Forget My Name, directed by David Bridle. Other favorite roles include Dunia and Tanya Sarachos. Is that how you say that?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I don't know how to pronounce the name of the play, though.
El Nogalar.
Okay, El Nogalar. Inspired by The Cherry Orchard. Oh, but that's nice. The title
really
character
great,
in Luis Alfaro's Electricidad?
Mm-hmm, Electricidad.
And Rosaria and Jose Rivera's Sueño. I don't remember that. Did it come to Northern California and I just missed it?
Electricidad?
Yeah.
I don't know if it's been. That was his first in his trilogy of Greek adaptations.
Oh.
And I'm not sure if it's made it up to the Bay Area. That's
oh,
a good question. It's been produced
one.
A lot now.
Oh.
Yeah. It was really great. The other night on Friday, mm-hmm. Luis did a solo performance,
mm-hmm.
and then he had three surprise guests. The first was Loretta Greco,
oh,
the director, actually read a monologue, and then Sean San Jose read a monologue from his newest play that's coming out, and then I read a monologue from Electricidad. So some of the folks got to see a little bite of the first one. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, what's that one? What Greek?
That takes on the Greek story of Electra, which is the young daughter whose father is killed, and she takes revenge on the mother and kills her mother. And Luis had actually met a young woman that was incarcerated for killing her mother in revenge for her father in a gang-related thing that happened in Arizona. And so when he read the story of Electra, it just blew his mind that, you know, he'd set it in East L.A., and it deals with girl gangs and what's going on with gangs. Yeah, so, you know, in the first one he takes on gangs and that culture. In Oedipus he takes on incarceration and what's going on in the prison systems. And then in this third one he takes on immigration and what it can do to a family. And it's just brilliant. It's just a great trilogy.
Oh, it is. It is. I was just thinking about Luis Rodriguez. You know, in East L.A., you know, he has with his wife.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Well, I hope
mm-hmm.
he brings that one up here. I'd love to see that one. That sounds fabulous.
Yeah.
And you're also a certified special education teacher. You have a master's
mm-hmm.
In gifted and twice exceptional education, and you have experience in social justice theater curriculum development. So you're just like...
Mm-hmm.
You know, wow.
Yeah, I get that. You know, I get it from my mom. She's an amazing mover and shaker, and I just can't quite sit around and do nothing. I started teaching right out of undergrad, and then got my master's and taught special ed for 5 years and was acting at the same time in the community in Albuquerque, but really found that theater, and especially I was inspired by Luis. I had my students rewrite the story of Antigone, and they set it in their neighborhood, and it had to do with warring gangs. And in Antigone, she dies in the end for trying to do the right thing. She's killed by Creon again. And my students decided, nope, she's not going to die. They're going to decide to work together and make the community better. And just seeing my students take that leap of reading a Greek play, rewriting it, acting it, and choosing to send a message of positive community enhancement was just mind-blowing. You know, theater's really, really powerful. And I love teaching as well.
Yeah, that's awesome. So tell us about Medea's children, and their twins, and that's symbolic within itself. And there's some other symbols, you know, like serpents and things like that, which I'll let people explore on their own. And then I wanted to ask you about your last name and the Zuni of it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, the twins, you know, there's a wonderful Mayan legend of the twin gods, and they're connected with this ancient game that was played with a ball that is what slowly developed what we think into soccer, also known as football in Latin America. And in the ancient times with the Mayans, that when that game was played, people were sacrificed. When the game was over, when the game was won. And there's a story about the hero twins and the twins being sacrificed. And so that kind of connected very nicely with the Greek myth of Medea and what happens to her children. So it sticks with the classic Greek tale, but it also brings a nice classic history from Mexico and able to, you know, have that wonderful culture be a part of it. Yeah. So my name, I have two last names. Zuniga is my father's last name, and Varela is my mother's last name. She kept her maiden name, so I have both of them. And we are not of the Zuni tribe. Zuniga is, it comes from Spain, from a family in Spain. My father's family is from southern New Mexico, in the Carlsbad area, and before that, from the state of Coahuila in Mexico. And it's an interesting name. I've met a few people that have the same last name that aren't related to me. There's a tribe of Navajo. There's a Navajo family in Gallup, I believe, west of Albuquerque, that are the Zunigas as well. And we are on that side, on the Zuniga side, we're actually White Mountain Apache and Mexican. So that's our native tribe is White Mountain Apache.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then the Varela?
The Varelas, that's my mother's side. They are from northern Mexico. My grandfather came over when he was 11 and ended up in New York, a chemical engineer, met my grandmother, who's German-Irish descent, and they had five daughters, and my mother is the oldest of the five, and she worked as a civil rights activist in the South for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
Nice.
And then moved to New Mexico to do work in the land grants movement. Her and my father met in northern New Mexico.
Wow, that is so cool. And are you an only child?
I am.
Wow.
And my mother and Luis actually know each other. I've known Luis since I was 11 years old. So that's a fun little, like, piece of trivia. For this.
So that's how you could use, because I was wondering, like, how, you're not teaching anymore, but so how could he inspire you to have your students rewrite the story of Antigone?
Yeah, well, I was doing Electricidad at that time, and I had known about the piece because my mother was also a MacArthur Fellowship winner. She won back in 1990.
A genius? A MacArthur genius?
Yeah, she got hers in 1990 for her economic rural development work that she did in New Mexico. And then Luis had, I don't remember the year that Luis got his, but I believe it was after my mother. And slowly there became more and more Latinos that started winning the MacArthur.
Yeah.
Sandra Cisneros, Guillermo Gomez Peña, an amazing collection of Latinos. So they started a little group called the Macaturos. And they would get together at different cities across the country and put on these Macaturo reunions and invite the community, and they would speak. And Luis and my mother, were a part of that. So I had known him since I was really little. And then I went to USC, and he's teaching at USC. So I got to have him as a professor in my third year of grad school. So, yeah.
Well, see, like the circles are so intertwined, aren't they?
Isn't it? The family is just, it's really wonderful. Luis talks about it a lot, just about the community and how the family just gets larger and larger, but at the same time smaller and smaller. You know how that happens. And the more,
yeah, certainly.
I've met people that know the whole cast that I'm working with that I've known, so it's really great.
Oh, that's awesome. What's your mother's first name so we can look her up?
Maria Varela.
Maria Varela.
Okay, mm-hmm.
Nice. And I know we weren't going to talk about serpents, but I was just thinking about sort of the Dambala, and sort of how serpents, snakes are looked at in a lot of different cultures, and how the serpent, the role of the serpent in Medea.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Again, when I was speaking with the curanderas that I was interviewing and dialoguing with about this piece, they were very intrigued about the use of the serpent, especially in the dress that is delivered to Creon's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
In the original tale, Medea sent, same thing, she sends a dress to the daughter and a diadem, you know, a piece of jewelry, and the dress and the diadem are poisoned. So when Glauce puts them on, it, you know, it poisons her. Same thing, Creon tries to help her and it poisons him. In this one, using the serpents was really interesting to the curanderas because they thought, wow, it's such a sacred symbol. You know, it's on our flag. It's on the Mexican flag. It's in the pyramids. There's a beautiful pyramid in the Yucatan called Chichen Itza. And on the autumn and the spring equinox, the sun goes through the top of the pyramid at the perfect point to form a shadow that zigzags down the stairs, and at the bottom of the stairs is a snake head. So the sun is in the perfect spot to form the body of the snake up the pyramid. So it's just, you know, it's very sacred. It's very, you know, it's transformative, and to use it for evil is a very big move.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very big statement. And then at the end, what kind of came out of it at the end with the movement with Medea transcending and elevating, it was interesting when they presented the stairs. When I first looked at the stairs, I thought, oh gosh, I have to walk up these stairs each night. That's going to be interesting. and I started playing on the stairs, and I just kind of started crawling up them kind of on all fours. It just felt more comfortable, and I just kind of liked it. And then the sound designer all of a sudden played this, you know, interesting snake sound. And then as you get to the top, and then Loretta was like, ooh, get her her palms. Let's get her her palms. And then I put the palms in my arms, and all of a sudden I was a bird. And that brings up the feathered serpent, which is in the Mexican mythology, the ancient, you know, Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent, which is a very strong symbol in Aztec and Mayan culture. And so it's just great to be able to combine that symbol. And yeah, it does. It has significance in so many different cultures. Quite revered in Mexico.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. A feathered serpent. Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Huh. And that also inspired that costume for the last part. You know, that wonderful costume piece kind of brings that all together.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I'm really happy for those who haven't had an opportunity to see the reimagining of Euripides' Medea, the world premiere, which is continuing through Sunday, July 1st. And you say that the 30th is dark, so on the 1st there's a 2:30 and a 7?
Yes.
Yes. 2:30 in the afternoon and the 7 p.m. And then so tonight, Wednesday, is 8 o'clock. Thursday 8 o'clock, Friday 8 o'clock?
Yes.
Okay, mm-hmm. Right.
And Friday night's always fun because Off the Grid is going on at mm-hmm. Fort Mason.
Mm-hmm.
So starting at 5 o'clock, the whole parking lot is filled with food trucks. So it's a really great thing to come. You can come have dinner and then come see the show at 8 o'clock. So that's a nice time to come on Friday night.
Oh, okay. That's good to know. Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is the Luis Alfaro's Bruja. And we are speaking to Sabina. And, wow, you were really phenomenal and looking forward to seeing you in some other plays our way.
Thank you. Thank
yeah.
you. I can't wait to get back up here to the Bay. I just love it. It's been such a warm community.
Yeah, it's really lovely. And why don't you give our audience your website so they can stay in touch and
definitely.
With your movement?
Definitely. It's all three of my names, SabinaZunigaVarela.com, SabinaZunigaVarela.
Okay, super. Well, thank you again so much. It's been really lovely. And people can get tickets and find out about this wonderful, wonderful play at Magic Theater. Theater spelled with a RE.org.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. This has been great. And, you know, there was one more, a quick story I wanted to share. I got an email yesterday from a audience member who came to see the show. He's a professor of law at the University of San Francisco, and his wife is a criminal defense attorney. And right now she's representing a Mexicana woman who killed three of her kids because of her husband, the fathers of the kids, leaving her.
Mm.
It was a real life Medea. So they wrote me and emailed me that it was incredible to see a play, and there, you know, how Luis was inspired by a young woman who actually killed her mother in revenge for her father. Mm. Unfortunately, this kind of stuff actually does happen, you know, and she's now being incarcerated for that. But it's really interesting to have heard that.
Right, and one thing, you know, when was Medea written?
Right, you know, back
yeah,
in,
yeah.
Was, yeah, so long ago, and I really do think that the Greeks and theater are, it's the one institution along with most arts that are just able to show the humanity
mm-hmm.
that that has always been here, that we're all a part of.
Right, certainly. I went to see Shakespeare at San Quentin, maybe 2 weeks ago. The Marin Shakespeare Company goes in and they you know take the men through these various classes and workshopping and so after you know working on this play Hamlet since last August they finally had their one production, and then they actually wrote their own response to the characters that they portray, and they're going to put that play on in August of this year as well.
Oh, that's so incredible.
But just listening to the men talk about how transformative it was
mm-hmm.
wearing these different roles.
Is powerful.
Theater mm-hmm. is really, really strong medicine, as they say. The arts are.
Agreed.
In general, and so I'm really happy that, you know, with all the cuts, you know, art is still happening, and in the magic.
Oh, it always
will.
Yeah, the
sure
magic
does.
Is incredible. Yeah, the fact that they've been doing this for 45 years, every play is some sort of premiere. It's new. It's an incredible place, and a lot of people don't know about the Magic Theater.
Mm.
You know, I met a guy last night having dinner after the show, and he's been living in this area for 25 years, and he had never heard of the Magic. So I gave him a flyer and invited him to the play.
Wow, that's awesome. Yeah, and you know, you think about the Magic, you know, sort of helping develop, you know, developing plays like, you know, investing in Luis Alfaro, so he
mm-hmm.
could do Bruja, and investing in Christina, I think her last name was Anderson, whose play Good Goods just closed at Crowded Fire, and so
mm-hmm.
you know she was able to work on another piece, and hopefully she'll be coming back through with it, you know, to stage it.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, so it's really
That'd
really wonderful. We have a really Northern California, San Francisco Bay Area is just really wonderful place. You know, for theater and for development of ideas, and we're so happy that you know, we get like the premiere and then it goes off to New York.
Yeah. Yeah, Bruja will be going to Arizona next, which will be fabulous because that's a very hot spot right now for immigration. So I'm really excited to see.
Yeah.
It's going to be really great.
It'll be perfect, yeah, and it'll be before elections, right?
Yes. Well, I believe so. Borderlands Festival. I don't remember exactly when it is, but I'm just very excited it's getting there because that's where this piece needs to go.
Oh, definitely, definitely. Yeah, there's a really wonderful cover story on Time magazine, and the person who wrote it, I can tell you his name in a minute, he actually, I think he spoke at La Pena Cultural Center recently, this past week. His name is Jose Antonio Vargas, and he's got a piece called We Are Americans, Just Not Legally, where some of the nearly 12 million undocumented immigrants living in the United States, why we're done hiding. And it's a really
Yeah, that was that cover that came out a while back. That's right.
Yeah.
I remember seeing that.
And the writer, you know, like I said, he was in town this past week or this week or last week. He was, because I got an email on it, but I couldn't go.
Yeah.
But I found the name so I could read the article.
Nice.
Well, I know you're going to really enjoy seeing those portions of the play that you couldn't see because you were in it, but now you can see, oh, wow.
Now I can see what it looked like. That'll be great.
Right. Well, you take good care. I look forward to meeting you. I had to dash off last night, but thank you so much for joining us.
Wanda.
All right.
I appreciate your help.
Oh, you're
welcome.
Okay,
take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
So that was really wonderful, speaking to Sabina about the Magic Theater's production of Luis Alfaro's Bruja. And again, that continues through July 1st. It is getting, it's been held over, which is really great. And now I'm going to play the second part of this wonderful interview I had with Georgia Horton. Couldn't play it yet, but here it is. And it's concluding our conversation. And again, Georgia is coming up for parole early November, like maybe this coming week. And we certainly hope she comes home. She's been away way too long. Okay, so tell me about Girlfriend, what happened, and what the program is. You said that it was a conflict resolution.
It's conflict resolution dealing with trauma.
Right.
And
how do you define trauma?
Trauma is anything that's been imposed on you and induced on you that had to do with anything mentally, emotionally, or physically. So that's the trauma. And a lot of times what happens is that because there's a lot of things that's going on, especially here, in the institution, which is the heartbeat to me, of all the issues that's going on in the world, it's like the dumping place. You be able to observe and do a lot of research about certain, behavior and situations and what's fueling all the things that's going on. Like I was saying, in society right now, a lot of people are focused on the outward anger issues and situations and not really coming to grips that what's going on the outside is really being produced by what's happening on the inside. And so that's what the things that the program deal with. It deals with the situation, the issue that goes on the inside of you, making you be able to cause insight and be able to bring awareness to what's going on the inside. And one of the major exercises that we start off with is called mirror reflection. And that exercise have you first view and look at yourself. It makes you look inwardly and identify the issues inside yourself. It's an evaluation tool that allows you to look through the only eyes that could be truthful and indicate what's really going on inside yourself is you. And then to ask yourself, what's really going on with me? What do I feel? Looking at myself. A lot of times, especially in incarceration, we tend to want to blame everybody else for our issues and our circumstances.
This recorded call is from an inmate at a California correctional facility.
And, of course, our issues might have been, initiated about abuse or rape. And, of course, these are valid things. But then it comes a time that we're going to have to look out and look inside, take some self-accountability,
and then start pulling out some of those issues, whether they're abandonment, loneliness, disappointment, delusion, neglect, addiction, insecurity, rejection, whatever those issues might be. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to start having to take accountability for those things. And so, you know, so the program is geared towards helping women deal with the situations, helping them identify the situations at first, and then dealing with the situations, and then giving you skills to cope with the situation,
mm-hmm.
changing your mindset and your view of how you perceive your situations and your circumstances around you.
Right. Yeah, and you mentioned that this is the only program developed by a person who's incarcerated that's been adopted by the California Corrections and Rehabilitation Department.
Yes.
And I wanted to know how long ago, like when did you develop this program, and is it being used outside of the California Women's Facility in Dublin? I mean, not Dublin, excuse me, in Chowchilla, California?
First question is how long I've been doing this program. This program is 8 years old.
Okay.
It got developed during my own rehabilitation. I found out that I was taking a lot of self-help and doing a lot of programs,
mm-hmm.
but then I didn't understand why, even though I was gathering all the data from the program, why I didn't have a longevity in my life. And so what I found out when I started doing some self-evaluation with myself is the same thing that the common doctor do once a person comes to the hospital. Before they start administering any kind of medicine or any kind of treatment, the first thing they do is they find out what's the problem, what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Because you wouldn't send a person that had a leg problem to x-rays or give them medication or treatment behind a liver problem. That would just be utterly ridiculous. So what I had to find out first is what was going on with me. And then so, and that's what I love about this program. This program to me is like an x-ray machine. Before you even go and be branched out to all the rest of the programs, first you need to know what's going on. What's the problem? What's the treatment that's necessary? Where is the pain located? And then once we find out what's the core issue, then we can start strategically putting you into treatment programs that's going to be geared towards the issue that you're facing, you know what I'm saying? And a lot of times when we're in trauma, we don't even know what's going on with ourselves. So that's one of the major things. Number two, you asked, is it being utilized outside the prison?
Mm-hmm.
That is my heart desire right now, and that's what I want so bad. I have no doubt that if
this recorded call is from an inmate at a California correctional facility.
To be able to give this program a voice on the outside, I have no doubt that just as effective as being inside the prison walls, that it will be outside the prison walls,
mm-hmm.
In any kind of department, in any kind of area, no matter what the situation you're dealing with, whether it's abuse, the problems in the education department, in the, any area that's out there, I know it will be effective, and that's what my goal is now. I'm trying to find some sponsors or find somebody that will be willing to come on side of me and be able to help carry this on the outside of the walls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was also wondering if it's being used in any of the other California women's or California institutions besides this one.
I would love it to be. That's why I'm saying. No, it's not. And I know that it's given the opportunity to have a voice or to be able to have an avenue where I could present it outside to an institution or any other place, I know it would be effective.
So how many women over the past 8 years would you say has actually come through your program? And you said your program is partnered with the chaplaincy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And it is people meet women that are part of this program 5 days a week, right?
Actually, I teach this program 5 days a week in an institution.
Okay.
On certain days in different areas. One day, certain days I teach it inside the chapel area.
Mm-hmm.
Certain days I teach it inside the drug program area.
Okay.
And some days I teach it in the mental health area.
Mm.
And how many women? I mean, thousands of hundreds of women have been through this program.
Mm.
And even the women that have been here for a long term, I find them re-entering back into it again because each time you take it, it takes you, you know, you come from a different level and you go more in depth with it. Also, it's like I said, it's been effective in the mental health department dealing with people that are coming on meds as well as getting off of meds.
Mm-hmm.
It also is used for reentry programs for people going back into society. So it, I know, like I said, it's given the opportunity and have somebody to be a spokesman to be able to take this program and be introduced to other prison systems as well as the men. It's not just gender response towards women. You know what I'm saying? It's men included. These questions are what happened is a question that needs to be asked to, I think, everybody that's in the institutional realm, you know, that's dealing with issues. Why did you get where you at? How did you get there? What was the initial stake? So I have a little separate thing that I'm waiting, so once I do parole, that will be called Girlfriend, What Happened, Man Included, which will deal with the stigma and the issues and abuse that men went through, especially the different, a lot of, especially in the black community, the rapes and the things that men have, you know, don't want to speak about or
impact. This recorded call is from an inmate at a California correctional facility.
I have a lot of visions and plans in the future.
Right. Yeah. I don't want us to run out of time. And you mentioned that you wanted to talk about some of the changes that are affecting the women. And you also mentioned something about gender response. And then I asked you about the question, what does it mean to be rehabilitated? So maybe we could do that part if you have to call me again. But why don't we start with something you said was really important about some changes that are affecting the women. You said it was, you know, really kind of critical.
Yes, and that involves gender response. One of the things that are really affecting the women here is that a lot of as we're the changes of the prison and things are altering. You know, right now we're in the middle of a major prison reduction, in situations where women are being relocated from one place to another. And when, especially if you're long-termer, that really affects the mindset because we tend to get adapted to where we're located. And so that's been causing an unsettling inside the rehabilitation center. And so right now that's why I think that I really wanted to give a voice to Gender Respond, because Gender Response programs are really necessary and needed in, to me in the institution right now. And those are programs that are geared towards women and their mental and emotional state. We all, you know, we have identified already that the issues that men deal with and the issues that women deal with are totally different. Right now, we are the first two prisons that are ever decided to make an emerge where you're taking people that have been in one prison for a long time, which is VSP, and placing them into another prison, which is CCWF. And that can sometimes be very difficult mentally and emotionally, because people think that we're in location that you just get physically attached, but no, you have emotional attachment as well as mental attachment. You know, so I was, I really just really would like to put emphasis on us during this time period, really, really bringing more rehabilitation programs that are gender responsive, that's really geared towards the women and their emotional well-being while they're in the middle of a transition.
So some of the women that are being transferred from Valley State are actually going to be relocated at the Central California Women's Facility?
They're, CWF, period.
Really? Okay. As opposed to just releasing the women?
Well, some are getting released, of course. You know what I'm saying? And I don't want to get into all that, because my concern is the ones that are coming over that have been rooted in one place for a long time. And, of course, changes is going to be a part of life, so we're going to have to adapt to change, you know. If you can't adapt, you know, if you're having issues transferring from one place to another, then...
This recorded call is from an inmate at a California correctional facility.
I think that that's the time that tools need to be really implemented, because you're planning on reentering back into society sooner or later. So if just coming across the street is going to cause you problems, then back into society should be something that you really look at. So, which is you know, I'm just saying, not trying to be funny or anything.
Yeah.
So, I think that, like I said, gender responsive programs right now geared toward the women's and the voices.
You have 120 seconds
really
left on this call.
Looked at right now.
Is your program Girlfriend, What Happened? Are you prepared to help facilitate this gender response? Is that included within your program?
Of course, yes. Yes, I am. Yes, I am.
Mm-hmm.
I really, really am.
Yeah. Okay. So I think we're going to have to continue this conversation again. And I wanted to mention the other programs you told me you were part of, you know, besides the long timers. You mentioned the SOAR reentry programs, the 2 years preparation for reentry program. And then, you know, you've got your own parole hearing coming up in July that we certainly need to talk about. And then I just wanted you to talk about just sort of, you know, I don't know if you can talk about this because
60.
Legally, but if you can, I wanted you to talk about, you know, what this journey has been like for you, you know, being on, you know, the slave plantation, because certainly there are a lot of similarities between our people being on plantations historically and, you know, in the antebellum South and now, you know, in these various prisons, California having the largest population of women incarcerated
right.
in the country and maybe even in the world.
Right. So I would like to readdress that question because they're going to cut us off again. And I will call you right back.
Okay.
I'll readdress that question. So give me a few minutes to regroup.
Okay.
I'm calling you right back.
All right. Super. Thanks a lot, Georgia.
I'll call you right back.
Okay.
All right.
Bye-bye. Yeah, Arianna, a whole lot of questions about you as we try to wrap up the other. Let's see. We were talking about, you know, sort of effective gender-based responses to, you know, transferring, you know, women from one facility where they have become acclimated
right.
to another facility, which is not far. You know, the two prisons look at each other. You know, the entrances
right.
are almost like right next to each other. But still, you know, one forms bonds and develops, you know, alliances, you know, wherever one happens to be. That's one thing about the human spirit. And so you talked about how, you know, your program, you know, certainly looks at that as well. And then I mentioned, you know, SOAR and
yes.
and then I asked you about to talk about, you know, sort of rehabilitation from the point of view that, you know, you're going up for the parole board
yes.
next month
yes.
and hopefully, you know, we're gonna hear some great news,
and you're gonna be
out. And I wanted to ask you to sort of, you know, turn the window in on yourself and talk about your rehabilitation process and how long you've been there. What is a long timer? Like, what does that mean? Like, how long have you been, you know, behind bars or on the new on the plantation, which, like I mentioned, I'm thinking about, you know, Michelle Alexander's book, you know, The New Jim Crow. I forgot the second part of the title. But anyway, it talks about how, you know, we've got so many of our people disappearing. I mean, they're being captured by the slave catchers, the modern-day slave catchers, and we talk about CDCR as certainly as, you know, one of the largest, you know, plantation holders, you know, in the world. And so whenever I, you know, one of our sisters comes back like Wanda Brown did, I sort of look at that as like, oh my God, the sister got off the plantation. Oh my God, after 27 years,
right.
we're so happy to have you back. We missed you. And that's why I just love, you know, the work that California Coalition for Women Prisoners does and other
yeah.
programs like that, you know, All of Us or None. You know, the California Habeas Project through Legal Services for Prisoners with Children, because that keeps us connected, because out of sight could often mean out of mind. And I'm sure that's something that, you know, women talk about in your girlfriend, what happened. It's like, I'm here, and I've been here like a long time, and my family used to come, they used to write, and now they don't anymore. And I just feel like abandoned. So anyway, but that's not the case with you, because you got a sister, you got a son, and we know you're there.
just to answer them seven questions.
Recorded call is from an inmate.
You ain't playing. And that's all right. I'm gonna try to get with you.
Okay.
The first question was that you posed to me was rehabilitation.
Mm-hmm.
And what rehabilitation means to me is to put back in good condition, or to reestablish a firm, sound basis, to bring or to restore to a normal state of health and constructive activity by medical treatment or physical or psychological treatment. And so you asked about, you know, about my upcoming parole hearing and how my change took place and how the institution and the prison being on slave camp and how it affected me.
Mm-hmm.
And so being that you pointed towards me, then I have to always be true within myself. Before I even got incarcerated, I dealt with a lot of traumas, starting with my childhood issues, dealing with a lot of molestation and dealing with a lot of situations and circumstances that were surrounding my child. As we know, my child was given away at birth for adoption, but then we know also just in the last year we've been reconnected, and we're dealing with that issue as I'm talking to you today.
Mm-hmm.
Another question that you said was, how did my change come about? Well, my change came about by being in the institution. It's amazing how when you've been put in a place of structure or any kind of pressure, I feel that it's going to affect you one way or another. Either it's going to make you for the worse or for the better. And it's a trip because I had to just, it was one of the questions that I had to ask myself, because it's one of the questions that the parole board is going to ask you. And so I had to really go and look deep within what was going on with me. And like I said, I came from a lot of emotional and mental abuse. I didn't have a lot of physical abuse, but I had a lot of emotional and mental and sexual abuse in my life. So I had a very low self-image. I had very poor insight towards myself. My mindset towards myself was very vivid to none. Because of what I went through, I didn't even have compassion or a lack of emotions towards anybody around me. I was disconnected emotionally and physically. The trauma that was imposed in my life made me disconnected, and that's how I dealt with the things that was in my life. I disconnected myself emotionally and physically. But as I came to the penitentiary, my education scores was very low, and the education department was one of the things that really breeded me into becoming back, stable. And one of the reasons why it wasn't just the conclusion of the information, the data of being grown, which even though being educated is a very good part of it, but we've been in the world long enough to know that education alone
is from an inmate at a California correctional facility
inside of society today. And so I just happened to be blessed to be connected to a teacher at that particular time that not only nurtured me physically, as educational-wise, but also mentally and emotionally. She was pouring words of life inside of me. And that's what was the beginning of my change in my life. That was the beginning of me coming back to life and realizing that I did have a purpose and that I could be utilized. As I continued to be encouraged in my goal setting and seeing that I had a purpose other than just utilizing my body and my mindset for destruction, then I began to find out that, hey, I can do other things. I can learn. I can educate myself. I can be utilized for other things. I can do, achieve other goals in my life. And in the process of that, today being one of the women that have finished, one of five women that have finished every vocational education program that's inside of CCWL, as well as designed a program to help deal with women's issues, and setting up here currently on my way to the board with a job offer, which I'm very excited about. Being on the plantation, I think that it's like choices. You have a choice no matter where you're located. You know, we all have bad starts, but it comes a time that you're going to have to take accountability about no matter where you're at. And Harriet Tubman is one of those prime examples to me. They were in slavery, and they could allow their circumstances to engulf them and slave them up. But even though at that particular time their bodies was locked down, their minds and their spirit could not be locked down from that. And because they were able to massage and embrace their mindset and be able to nurture that part of them, they were able to create a vision where we know that that's why slavery started becoming free. And so we all know that freedom first starts on the inside. Location has nothing to do with that. We have to put that aside and realize that freedom first comes within yourself before it can even, no matter where you're at. You can put somebody free today, release them today, but if they're not free mentally, emotionally, and spiritually, what good is it? You're going to wind up putting yourself right back in the same situation that you're in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, wonderful. I was wondering how many programs. You said you are one of the only persons that has completed every every program. How many programs does that mean?
Oh, wow. Well, vocation, here at the vocation over the prison system right now, we know because I was one of the blessed women that came to prison way back. I've been incarcerated for 22 years. Mm-hmm. So at that time, we had numerous of programs. Graphic arts is one of the programs I graduated from, office services, dental technician, auto mechanic at that time, landscaping, painting.
This recorded call is from an inmate at a California correctional facility.
Electronics, just to name a few. I'm trying to name them off from the top of my head.
Wow.
And so those were some of the things that was offered at that time when I came in that I was blessed to be able to partake in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now today we're very limited in our programs behind the CDC because of the cutback.
Okay. Yeah, and so you said you have a job offer, and can you tell us what field?
I would gladly. I'll be working for a program in Los Angeles area called Family Connection and Company.
Mm-hmm.
And the executive director of Family Connections is Peggy Martin, and she's an MD. And what she does is she has a nonprofit organization that helps people in the Los Angeles area organize different events and stuff for the justice system.
Hmm.
So she helps with rehabilitation, and she helps reestablish people back into society.
Mm-hmm.
And she helps with family organizations to make the foundation more rooted and more steadier. And so through social power and in changing the community strategy, families through apprenticeship.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so
yeah.
That's what we'll be doing. I'll be working with her.
Okay.
Sharing
yeah.
some of the things, some of the information and data and the things I've been through to bring to the program.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. One of the persons that I visit is Carlita, and she was a good friend of Debbie's as well. And you mentioned Debbie Higler, you know, that she was significant in your life, you know, the way that Harriet Tubman was significant in the lives of so many others. And I remember in the story of Harriet Tubman, there's a wonderful musician here I saw last night at a program I went to called House of Matter. Nicole Clay Moon, her embodiment project sort of looks at different types of issues. In this particular one, she's a sexual abuse survivor. And so what I was taking from the dance spoken word production, which also had live music, was that one needs to, it was about looking, it's about love, and the first love one needs to have is love for oneself. And I was wondering if you could talk about, and also I was thinking that Carlita said that she ended up getting a 2-year degree from Patton College, and I was wondering if you had also in one of these various programs that you participated in, had you been able to do that too?
Unfortunately, what had happened was before Featherific had started.
This recorded call is from an inmate at a California correctional facility,
which is the college course that she had started.
Start over again. The recorder was talking over you. I didn't understand it.
Unfortunately,
mm-hmm.
Featherific. Unfortunately. By the time Feather River came, which was the second college course.
Oh, Feather River, you mean?
Yes.
Okay, uh-huh.
Which was the second college course that was offered in the institution.
Mm-hmm.
The first one was called, I lost my thought.
Mm.
What was the first college course?
You have 120 seconds.
And so,
left on this call.
Was the first college that was offered here,
mm-hmm.
and that was the program that I was in, Coastline. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And unfortunately, in the process of Coastline, going through Coastline, Coastline lost its funding.
Oh.
And so the people, so when
Feather River.
Mm-hmm. Feather River came up, the people that was already in Coastline couldn't sign up for that.
Oh.
So she was able to sign up for that program and continue that. And so the ones that when Coastline fell through, the ones that was in the process of that had to sign up behind the girls that the list had already got started.
Oh.
And so, yes, unfortunately, that if I was one of those people.
Oh, that got cut because of the other.
Right,
yeah,
the
right.
Thing. But okay. That's okay. When I get home, I'm planning on continuing my education, going way further.
Mm-hmm.
You know, doing that.
Yeah. So talk about Debbie, Debbie Pigler. You know, the film Crime After Crime is, you know, so look to her life.
On this call.
They just said 60 seconds again.
Okay, right. Well, go ahead and say what you can and then call me back.
Debbie Pigler was one of my closest friends as well as Carlita Stewart.
Mm-hmm.
I was in the film with her. I participated with that with her. Matter of fact, the song Climate with the rest of the development, we was there together producing, so I was able to be hand on hand with her on that. And she was also my spiritual mentor here in the institution. We did a lot of things together. One of the things that the film talked about was about her struggles on this side of the prison, but they didn't know also the another half of her that they didn't know about. And that she, even though it took her a while and she did a long fight for her physical freedom, she was spiritually free a long time ago. She's a very remarkable woman. I was able to work up under her for 18 years, which I consider a privilege. And one of the things that the reason why I picked her to be one of my ancestors.
We were cut off. She'll call us back.
I tried to go as long as I could.
Yeah, that was great. We should definitely talk it out since we got to pay for it anyway. So you were telling me about Debbie and your work with her for 18 years. Wow, long time.
Yeah.
And how she was, you know, she was spiritually and mentally free long before, you know,
before.
She physically was released, you know, Was her release eventually compassionate release because she was, you know, terminally ill?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it's really messed up the way, you know, women serve, you know, people serve such long terms. And you know, her case was racked with inconsistencies and illegal maneuvers. And yet, God, how long was she incarcerated before she finally got out?
Oh, I think like 28 years.
Yeah, and she was supposed to be out a long time before that because they were just really messed up.
Yeah,
you just messed her around. Mm-hmm.
Fighting the judicial system.
Yeah. You know, and there's also, you know, a habeas project, you know, case.
Right.
Yeah. Is your case also habeas?
No.
No? Okay. Yeah. No. So talk about your mentor and your spiritual mentor and your friend and sort of how and what you talked about with regards to you know, when you pour libations yesterday, June 9th, you know, that you pour libations for Harriet Tubman and you pour libations for, you know, for the Harriet Tubman spirit and Debbie.
One of the reasons why it was really effective or really, really touched me is because I was incarcerated, so I wasn't able to attend her funeral.
Oh.
And that was really, you know, to be walking with somebody that long and not be able to, you know, say your goodbyes in a proper manner. It was really, especially as close as we was, it was very heartbreaking to me. And so I had always said to myself since her death, that was something I was going to do once I get out.
Mm-hmm.
And I never seen a way to be able to achieve that behind the walls until yesterday.
Wow.
And so that's why it was something that was so passionate and for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I seen a way not only to say goodbye to her, but then to pay tribute to her. And like I said, that tribute would be for the whole month of June.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just sparked something in me, and it gave me hope. It also gave me insight and another area that we don't have to be stagnated behind the walls. And
call is from an inmate at a California correctional facility.
I'm excited to see, because I'm going to keep a daily journal on what happens as I keep her spirit in mind through the month of June.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm really excited to see what insight what's going to come and how it's going to affect me and how it will affect the lifestyle. My lifestyle and the lifestyles of others that took that challenge.
Mhm. Yeah, because I just think about, you know, what you wrote after, you know, you know, your circle and that you had, you know, your regular circle you have in the morning on Saturday, and introducing this whole thing around the libations for the ancestors. And I just wanted to mention that, you know, Debbie has been walking with you all this time anyway, as well as, you know, your other ancestors, and I think of ancestors like angels, you know, watching over us. It's just, you know, a lot of times if we don't call their name, if we don't acknowledge their presence, then that connection that you made, you know, you know, in a concrete way through that action of pouring water, you know, for her and calling her name, then, you know, there's not really that tangible sort of acknowledgement that we need as people, you know, because we're made out of flesh, and so, you know, we need to connect with things like that we can see and hear and touch and feel and smell. And so I just wanted to mention that, you know, if you this ancestor reverence, you know, veneration is something that maybe might become a practice.
I'm really planning on implementing it into the program.
Mm-hmm.
I know for a fact that got birthed, and I won't take that from the women.
Mm-hmm.
That'll be something that we'll continue to do here in this program.
Yeah, because there's a woman, her name is Savanfu Somme, and she's from Burkina Faso in West Africa, and she's a spiritual healer, and she talks about ancestors, and she says that when people die, they get smarter, and we can give our ancestors, we can give them things to do for us. Like, we can say, okay, can you, like, take this and work on this, and, like, okay, I'm coming up for a parole board hearing July 11th. July 11th. Okay, so Debbie, can you work on that for me? You know, can you work on the hearts of those men and women that are going to be sitting there judging me, to be open to what I have to say, to not be closed by things they might have read in my file, or things they might have seen on TV, or what something might be in their personal life that has nothing to do with me, and it might keep them from seeing me or hearing me, and grandmother, blah, 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 or grandfather, or cousin, so-and-so. You can ask them all to do things for you.
Right.
Yeah, give them things to do. They need to be busy because they have all this time. That's all they have is time. Lots of it.
Right. Well, my time is getting short again, so I wanted to know if there was anything else that you wanted.
Yeah, I want you to talk about being a mother. Mother's Day just passed. Happy Mother's Day. I said Mother's Day just passed. Happy Mother's Day.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah.
First one with my son.
Yeah, tell me about that. Tell us about being a mother and, having Brandon back.
Okay, well, I know I'm going to wind up closing out with this, so I want to first just thank you for allowing me to have a voice. And I really do appreciate you honoring us and really caring about us behind the walls. I don't take that lightly. It's very rare that we get a chance to be treated in a humane way. And so when somebody of your status and your caliber pour that type of acknowledgement and love and towards and hope towards me and towards us behind the walls, it is something that ignites us and gives us energy to go further. And I will be sharing that today when I read my speech and sharing that with the women, also about you. So I just really want to thank you for that. I thank you so much from the bottom of my heart. I really, really, really do appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome, Georgia.
About my son, it was our first Mother's Day, I didn't get an opportunity to be with him on Mother's Day. Unfortunately, financial didn't allow that to happen. But I was trying to share with him that our Mother's Day didn't start that day. My Mother's Day started the day we got reconnected back together.
Mm-hmm.
And that will be the day that we celebrate. It's been very joyful. At the same time, it's been really heartbreaking because to find your child and didn't have your child find you in prison with a 25-to-life sentence is sort of very hard. Because you only have a portion of that reconnection, that reuniting can only be that reunion only can go so far, you know. And so of course, you know, we're working through that, and of course we're very happy to have each other back in our lives, and of course we realize the miracle that we have each other after 28 years. But at the same time, you know, our fight is still on, and that's me and him being able to be physically connected back together. I'm really grateful at the condition that he's in. He's a wonderful young man. You know, he was blessed to be able to exercise all the things that were going to him mentally and mostly through fighting. So he's a martial arts specialist. Right now he's separated himself from that, and now he's with my family trying to get himself back together mentally and emotionally. He was also looking for employment at that time because he didn't want to be fighting, because we know that when you're doing martial arts fights, you have to be emotionally shut down. And so to deal with him finding his family now, he couldn't be.
This recorded call is from an inmate at a California correctional facility.
He's having struggles right now financially, trying to find a job and this thing, but I know I have hope that he will. But in the meantime, I just want to just continue to, that we will keep lifting him up, you know,
mm-hmm.
that he will become whole inside himself, and which to me is the most important thing, for him to get emotionally and mentally healed.
Right. Mhm. Yeah. And I don't know how much time we have, but how did you end up being reunited with Brandon?
I had never stopped looking for him, and so thank God Deborah Pigler had a big part in that too, because she knew my heartache over the years concerning that, and upon her freedom, she put out a website to assist that. And with the data and information, I was able, through her and numbers of other people that was assisting me,
mm-hmm.
help bring that unification back together.
Wow. And how can people outside of the prison help you with, you know, success, you know, at your upcoming board hearing? What can people do to help you?
Well, all the support I could get right now would just be the most wonderful thing. Just supporting me any kind of way you feel need or feel comfortable doing so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what ways could that take?
Letters, writing to Sacramento on behalf of me,
mm-hmm.
telling them that they believe that my life of rehabilitation has been transformed, and that they support my release.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so should they write you or write someone else?
They can write straight to me.
Okay, why don't you give your contact information?
My name is Georgia Horton, and my W number is W33911. My housing is 512, room 20, 3 low. So you'll write that 512-20-3 low. I'm at CCWF, and then under that you will put CCWF, and then under that you'll put Chowchilla, California, 93610, and then the P.O. box is 1508.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I want you to talk about your sister has been real supportive, right?
Yes, she has. I have a sister named Patricia Lucas, and oh, my God, not just with me being here, but also with my son, she's taken him in, and she's been a surrogate mother for him right now, and I'm just so grateful for that. She's been there hands-on to be able to be a go-between between me and him, emotionally, mentally, and physically, and I'm just really grateful for her. I'm really thankful for her. I'm just blessed to have her stationed right there with the compassion that she has and the love that she has for us.
This recorded call is from an inmate at a California correctional facility.
Hello?
Yeah, we're still here. So you're going to be paroled in L.A., and your sister is in Northern California, and your son was in Northern California. How did you lose him?
Because when I became pregnant, at that time, my mother wasn't approved of me being underage, so he was put up for adoption.
Oh, how old were you when you had him?
I was 15 when I got pregnant.
I was 15 when I got pregnant and 16 when I had him.
Okay, was that one of the molestation situations you mentioned?
No, I wasn't raped. He wasn't from a rape situation. He was out of wedlock.
Oh, and your mother put him up for adoption, and because you were underage, you couldn't say anything.
Yeah.
Wow, and so from 15 until last year, You didn't have any contact with your son?
No, ma'am.
Wow, that's a long time.
Yes, it is.
Wow.
Time meeting each other.
Wow, but that was really beautiful. I'm sure you've written about that, right?